Seacoast Nation. This is, as you can see, a really exciting lecture. You're probably asking yourself, why is this an exciting lecture? Why are we actually doing this? You guys all know the platforms. You all applied to med school. You all got into med school. Obviously, you know how to follow instructions and fill the forms. And up until recently, this has been sort of the way that we approach doctors. Obviously, you guys know how to do this, so we don't have to teach it. I have to introduce myself. My name is Dr. Luke. I'm a family doctor here at the CLA Seacoast Nation. I'm a family doctor at the Santo de la Academia Substance Abuse Treatment Center. And I'm also the undergrad coordinator here at the CLA Seacoast Nation. So I sort of wear three hats, and in a period of about 2 months, a month, 2 months, maybe 3 months, I actually got hit at all three hats, which is kind of funny because the coroner sent off an email to all doctors at the in substance abuse rehabilitation centers in Quebec, highlighting the fact, the importance that if, by the way, you guys see people who shouldn't be driving, maybe they shouldn't be driving. Now, coroner's reports usually mean that people have died. So this is a red flag from a substance abuse standpoint. From a regular friendly medicine standpoint, we also got an email from the Faculty of Education saying, from the Faculty of Medicine, saying that that doctors should also be really important to fill out proper forms, because if you see patients who shouldn't be driving, they shouldn't be driving. This was a different coroner, a different report that also made its way to me. And the third one, actually, is that this is actually based on an OSCE that has since been pulled from the session, so you're not going to get it, in which you guys, as third-year med students, are exposed to a you are exposed to a patient who needs to fill out his medical certificate to say that he can keep driving a truck, and in the process, you guys all find out that he has a problem with cannabis. And as you're about to put the pen on the paper to say you shouldn't, you got a problem with cannabis, he says, hey, if you do that, I'll stop. I'll lose my license. I'll lose my job. You can't do that. And despite the fact that this is a simulated environment, despite the fact that you know that you're being graded, despite the fact that you know that you're being watched and that this isn't real, about half of you chose not to fill out the form properly. So this was sort of like, wow, an eye-opener. So we're going to get started. We're going to chat a little bit about how to fill out forms and how to do it properly. And we're going to start with a coroner's report. It's such a nice way to start on a Friday morning. So this is a 66-year-old man who was walking on a bicycle path separated from the road by a grass. Alcohol were not a factor, and the question is, why was this young driver, how did this accident take place? It wasn't a mechanical failure. The driver was on her way to see her doctor to fill
an SAEQ form, and which is kind of ironic. However, she was being prescribed 16 different medications, of which many had the capacity to alter her mental functioning. I have no idea which medications they're referring to, but in my most sick patients in nursing homes that I've seen, 16 different medications is an enormous number of medications, and this is, if many, it can alter her mental functions. One has to ask the question, is this person capable? You guys sort of pick, maybe over there is probably a good place to sit down. And we've got three clickers here. One, two, three. Excellent. And is this the copy of it? So this is a copy of the coroner's report that you guys can pass around. You can look at it if you want. What is an SAEQ form? And we'll be talking a little bit about it. This is an SAEQ form. It is also called an M28 form. It is basically a summary form that the government sends to doctors to make sure that the government knows if you have any medical issues that you should or should not be driving. It's extremely comprehensive. This was a different case. It's a 68-year-old lady who was killed when her car was struck head-on by an oncoming vehicle. And the oncoming vehicle will be referred to as the driver. The driver was headed in the wrong direction and subsequently was rear-ended. The accident took place at 5:05 p.m. And the coroner asks the question, why was the driver unable to stay in his lane? The date is 2009 when this event is taking place. This took place in a the details surrounding it, it was in a construction zone with diverted traffic. The driver had been recently moved to a nursing home 2 months prior to the incident. And the driver on multiple occasions to both friends and to his doctor explained he should probably stop driving. The week prior to the collision, he was noted to be confused and disoriented in the afternoon. And after the collision, while he was in the hospital, he was given the diagnosis of Alzheimer's dementia. Yes. Fire away.
He was driving in the opposite lane and then got rear-ended?
He was driving in the... No, the 68-year-old lady was subsequently rear-ended.
By the car coming in the...
Okay, so the 68-year-old lady is dead. She was driving in her car properly. She's doing the right things. Hi. Hi. We are driving. She's a 68-year-old woman is driving in the right way. Okay. A car is driving in the wrong direction, hits head on, causes a head on collision. The car behind the 68-year-old lady rear ends her. The 68-year-old woman gets squished between two cars. So the question is, who was at fault? And it was determined that it was the driver in the wrong direction who was considered at fault. And why were they at fault? What are your thoughts when you guys see this? What's going through your minds?
There's lots of people in my neighborhood that shouldn't be driving.
Okay, it's kind of scary, isn't it?
Yeah.
What neighborhood do you live in?
A lot of old people.
What are your thoughts about this? Anyone? Besides, gee, maybe he shouldn't be driving. One thing that the coroner was quite critical of is that how could this person have been given an insta-diagnosis of Alzheimer's dementia in the hospital hours after an accident or a day or two after the accident, given that this is a chronic disease with a very long lead-in time. So the more damning part comes in when the driver was seen by his family physician, who filled out that M28 form in 2008 and was noted to have absolutely no disabilities on file. And the driver was also seen 2 weeks prior
to the collision, and no contraindications to driving were noted in the medical file. This is what we call an oops moment in medicine. We try to avoid these moments because they can result in lawsuits, they can result in death, and they can result in coroner's reports, like these last two reports. This one I thought was especially scary because... This one, to be fair, the doctor didn't actually do anything wrong. You've got a clicker here. This one, actually, the driver didn't actually do anything wrong. Sorry, not the driver, the doctor. I mean, she was on her way to see the doctor. We're going to think about this in a little bit. So we're going to start by asking you guys a few questions. You've all got your clickers. Get them ready. And... we'll just ask the first question and see how you guys do, and then we'll carry on a discussion. And this is going to be a very open discussion. And we're going to start with the sentence, lying is good. And you can answer true or you can answer false. You can think about this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. I want to see 15 responses. I want to see 16 responses. And you can click true or false. And I'm going to get you a clicker. I want to see 16 responses up there. Nobody can abstain. You might want to slide down a little that way. No pressure. 12, 13, 14, 56. Four people haven't answered. Four people aren't sure if this is true or false. Three people haven't answered. Okay, one person hasn't answered. Okay, I'm assuming it's you. Lying is good. That's the question. Do you agree with that statement, or do you disagree with that statement? One person has chosen not to answer. I want everyone to answer. Everyone must answer. Everyone click your answer a second time. I want all 16 people to answer. There are no abstainers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There are 16 people here, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. Excellent. Thank you. Good. Now, let's see what people said. Okay, so I don't know the percentage, but some people said true, most people said false. A show of hands, who in this room has ever lied? Excellent. So for everyone who said false to this one and lifted up your hand, there's a little contradiction. These rules don't apply to us. You know you're doing a bad thing, but you do it anyway. All right. So who said, out of curiosity, who said true? Okay. Now, why did you say true? Can you give me an example where lying is good?
If it's going to cause the person more harm than good. It's like a white lie.
I like that shirt on you. Okay. okay, good. That was a joke, by the way.
Yesterday at my PA meeting, and I was talking about how in clerkship I've kind of learned to put on a facade for different people in order to get them to do what I want them to do. You know what I mean?
Okay, so you're learning to be manipulative.
Everyone has a different facade depending on the situation.
Absolutely.
But it seems like in medicine you have to have a much wider range in order to actually communicate with your patients and to understand them even. And sometimes if you don't do that, you say what's exactly on your mind, they're just going to walk out of your office.
Fair enough. So what you're saying is you kind of have to go into that gray zone.
Keep the ball rolling. Okay. And your answer?
Oh, similar to this. I mean, I'm considering lying and being good. Sometimes an omission of truth is sometimes necessary in that an individual knowing all the information in a given situation may not be of benefit.
Okay. Fair enough. And you both of you, I'll pick on two at a time, both of you said that the statement was false. Can you comment on what your colleagues just said? Because they obviously disagreed with you.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Do other people who said false have other comments that they want to either rebut what your colleagues have said? Yes, absolutely.
So most of what people said were omissions and not lies.
Okay.
So you don't tell somebody everything, but that's not a lie.
Okay.
Second of all, lying is good is a statement that it implies that it is better to lie than to tell the truth, where in while there are situations where lying is necessary, it is not more good than telling the truth.
Okay.
And the times that in which you would use it would be times in which you are weighing two evils and one being less.
Less of an evil. Okay, fair enough. And you had a comment also? And I'll get back to you, yeah?
If you lie, like to give it for a therapeutic alliance, if your patient finds out that you lied or that you omitted the truth, well, there goes your therapeutic alliance. It's way worse than it is to tell the truth to your patient.
Depends on what you're lying about. It really does. I mean, if you're really admitting something important that I think the patient may have a right to know, even if you don't think so, that's one thing. But if a patient comes to you with a problem that you're so superficial in your mind, you're just like, oh my God, shut up, I don't care. But you have to actually pay attention to them if you want them to trust you, right? Even though that problem will have no bearing on their medical care whatsoever.
But that's not lying.
This is. I'm lying about my state of mind. Oh, I'm not giving the truth, though. I'm saying, I feel so bad for you. If I tell someone, I feel so bad for you, I'm lying to them, for sure.
That was a stretch.
What
is like 99% of the time that the patient's going to do whatever the doctor says anyways, and I find often the doctor's making, the patient's making their own decision, but that's not the case anyway.
Okay.
So you probably don't have to lie.
Okay. So we're hearing, what I'm hearing is that a really straightforward question, like lying is good, true or false, is actually not quite as straightforward as it is on the surface. I'm going to hit you with a whole lot of binary questions like this, and you guys can agree with it or disagree with it. And sometimes people feel frustrated and they say, but that's not fair because there's all these gray zones in the middle. And the reason I'm giving it these questions to you is because often these are the pitfalls that you're going to run into. You've all had ethics lectures. You all have been told how a simple binary question can in turn break down into multiple sub-questions and multiple issues, and how one is related to the other. And what was simple at first becomes much more complex. What I want to do is I want to close the loop. After all is said and done, it's nice to meditate and think about this, but you got to actually do something, and you got to actually commit to an answer, and you got to actually say true or false. You've got to either pick up the phone or don't pick up the phone. You've got to check off, you've got a diagnosis that makes you can't drive or you can't drive. Like, after you've weighed all the pros and the cons, you're going to be stuck with a binary decision that you must reach. And so I'm actually trying to push you guys to that next level to reach a final decision. I must document truthfully in the medical chart. So I want you to think about this and go through all these thoughts in your mind. And you can, again, you can agree with it, you can disagree with it. A lot of these have maybe a very strong, obvious answer, and maybe when you start thinking about it, you can get yourself tangled up because there's not so... these guys do have gray zones. Two of you have chosen not to answer. One of you has chosen not to answer. Thank you. How did people answer? Okay. So again... most of you said true. This is a good thing, by the way. But I'm curious to know why people, more than one person said false in this room. And I would like to know who said false in this room. The point of the clickers is I could do this with a show of hands. But then you get groupthink. Everyone else is lifting up their hand. I'll lift up my hand too. I don't want you to fall into groupthink. I want you. You individually are on the spot. When you're in the office with the patient, it's just you and the patient. You don't have 25 other people sitting behind you going, yeah, do it, you know, or don't do it. It's you. That's it. This is reality. Who said false? I didn't say false. Who said false? Let's go back to the first question. Lying is good. Don't lie. I'm serious. More than one person said false. I'd like to know what, and there are gray zones here. We saw the first one, there were gray zones. The second one, there were gray zones too. Gone, guys. You guys are chickening out. Okay, true or false? We're going to go around the room then. We're going to single each one of you out.
True, but I considered putting false.
Okay. Did you say false? You said false. Excellent. So we got one person to say false. I think more than one person said false, but that's okay. Why did you say false?
Well, again, it's more, I would say, more of an admission than a lie.
Okay.
I come across an information that's totally irrelevant, but that could have serious consequences.
Totally irrelevant, but serious consequences. Can you give me a concrete example? Yes.
24-year-old student.
I'm going to repeat this for the camera. So a 24-year-old student.
Coming for a periodic health exam.
Periodic health exam.
And coming from a place where drug is very, very, very bad.
Okay.
He smoked weed once to try it.
Okay, so he comes from a place where drugs are prevalent and...
No, he shouldn't do drugs.
Okay. Okay. So he goes to a place where drugs are prohibited, and he says he smoked a joint.
As is here. Once,
yeah.
2 years ago.
2 years ago. He smoked a joint.
Would you write drugs? Would you write, non-user? Would you say tried? Or you just omit it?
Okay.
He said he smoked weed once. But you know, if you write it down...
there could be legal consequences.
If the company asked for it, or for any reason, his chart is pulled, they say, oh...
what are your thoughts?
I just wanted to say that's exactly why I considered putting false.
Okay.
I was just ethically conflicted. Because it's true, because you have a patient who may say, you know what, I smoke a cigarette maybe once every 2 months or something. When I go out, I smoke one or whatever. You put that in their chart and it's there forever. And when they want health insurance, then it's really going to impact that, and that was what I was thinking.
But they are smoking.
Social
smoker.
But think about you. But think about yourself. I was just trying to put myself in that position of how I would feel.
Okay.
How I would feel if I wanted to get health insurance and putting that in my chart.
Fair enough. Yeah, definitely. I'm going to buy it. No regular use.
Oh,
Okay.
Doesn't say he's using, but he's, that's what's relevant to us, is that he's not taking regular drugs.
Okay. What if I told you the insurance company's definition of a smoker is, have you smoked one cigarette within the past 365 days? Let's say on New Year's Eve you got a picture of you on Facebook smoking a cigarette or smoking a joint, and that's on Facebook because the insurance companies know about this because they call them Facebook and all that stuff. And you said no, you're not a smoker.
Everybody calls Facebook now.
That's not good.
Let's say it was a fake one.
It was a Popeye cigarette. It was a little candy one. You're a Canadian, so there's a question about insurance. Who has access to what? So the thing is, okay, you're my patient, and you apply for life insurance. Let's say, life insurance is going to say, who's your doctor? You're going to say, I don't have a doctor, and they're going to say, wait a second, your Medicare card's gone through the government, so what's the deal? So you're going to say, okay, yeah, my doctor's
Dr. Luco. So they're going to say, we insist that you sign a release of information to allow us access to Dr. Luco's chart, to your chart with Dr. Luco. You're allowed to refuse it, but then they're allowed to not give you your insurance. So if you want the insurance, basically you have to sign it, and then what happens is the insurance company sends that photocopy to me and says, send us a copy of your chart, or answer the following questions. And then I answer the questions based on the information that I have. That's how the information transfer works.
So we shouldn't put down that anybody does any drugs or smokes or drinks any alcohol.
No, but if we do, you should put it down, because that's what's relevant to the...
So we should use more and more arcane medical lingo.
Our goal is not to like screw insurance companies. Like, that's not what we're doing.
Well, it's funny that you say that because I've got a question here. It's funny. Guys, this is interesting. So, is it relevant that our patient is smoking?
Yeah.
Is it relevant that our to know if our patient is drinking?
Yeah.
It's not relevant to know if they've smoked once or twice.
Is it?
Maybe
even
a 13-year-old teenager.
He's saying, yeah, I had some marijuana 10 years ago. Like, what's that going to make a difference to their health?
Right. It's not. Yeah. You might want to document it, though.
Why?
You should document it as no significant drug use.
Significant is a really loaded word, though.
But then you make that standard, and then you never have to talk about one joint again.
So it is sometimes justified to lie, and I'm going to jump to the next two questions here. It's sometimes justified to lie on a government-issued form. What is a government-issued form? So we've got the M28 that I just passed around. You've got a passport application form. You've got a welfare disability form. You've got an application to an HLM or a subsidized housing. These are forms that go through the doctor's offices that for one reason or another, it goes to a government office, be it a city, a municipal, federal, provincial. This is as opposed to, say, Bell Canada or Manulife or McGill as a private institution. So this is for a government-issued form. It is sometimes justified to lie on a government-issued form, true or false. I only see six of you who have answered, and I've completely demoralized you guys. None of you want to click. Okay, so by the end of the session, you're all going to be liars. This is good. So who, it is sometimes justified to lie on a government-issued form in what context? Some of you had said yes. More than one of you said yes, because now we're up to 25%. Out of 16, that means what, 4? Is that right? 4 times 4, 6? Yeah, so 4 of you said yes. Okay, yes. Good. You saw the M28 that I just passed around. So there.
However, I think it's important to note that there's a very big difference between what's moral and ethical and what's legal. And you know, the government is just filled with people, and often laws can be very unfair. And if you're going to lie in a government form, which I think sometimes is justified to do, the only thing is, I mean, there are practical consequences to doing that. If you're willing to take responsibility for that, then go ahead and do that. But I think that there are definitely situations where it can be ethical and moral to lie on a form.
Give me an example.
I can't. I'll think of one. I'll think of
Okay, can somebody give me an example? More than one of you said that the statement was true.
Are we in Canada, or is the government evil?
Evil! Well, it depends on your political views. Did the good guys win the election, or did the bad guys win the election? That depends on your political views. Seriously, three more of you guys said that statement is true. I want an example that supports this. It's not a law question.
No, it is a law question. It's absolutely a law question.
Why?
Because I am asked to find a law that I believe would be unethical to follow in its entirety.
Okay.
You know, some person is moving to Canada and needs a medical report and can't have ever, I don't know, smoked a joint in there.
And they tell you that they smoked the joint.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I don't know what the law is. In the States, it wouldn't be.
Who said true? Show of hands. I want four people to lift up their hands. True, 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 and a fourth, and true. Excellent. So you guys, help out your colleagues here.
Pretty much what he said. Having one cigarette, having a joint, something.
That's not a law.
Explain to me how that is relevant to. Explain to me how that's relevant to a government-issued form, please. Yes.
It has substance use on it.
It has substance abuse. Correct. So the question is, based on DSM, chronic substance abuse, substance dependence, substance use. So basically, this, though, comes on after here. Amount, how frequently, since when? So if the person says, I smoked a joint once when I was 12, if you want to dot your I's and cross your T's, you could say, smoked a joint when he was 12. And you know what? You'd be wasting a lot of time on the government's hands because they're going to look at this and say, wow, that's an anal retentive doctor, and they're going to put it away, and they're not going to do anything about it because nobody in their right mind would crucify you because you smoked a joint when you were 12. Not when you smoked a joint when you were 12.
Fine, but maybe within the last year, so you smoked.
Okay, so now is it relevant? Is it relevant to know that the person is smoking a joint on a regular basis?
Yeah.
What is the definition of regular? Once a week? Once a month? Once a year? On my birthday, I smoke one joint. Is that regular? Well, sure, it's regular. It's once a year. Yes.
You're in the States, and the year is earlier than it is now, and your patient tells you that you've been asked to do a medical exam for his entrance into the Army.
Okay.
And he tells you, you say, oh, sexual orientation? Do you have sex with men, women, or both men? And then the form is asking you things about
sexual.
Well, it used to be, and he told it to you, and so now all of a sudden you are asked on the government issue form, do you have anything else to say relevant to his ability to be in the Army? And the Army is homophobic, and you are asked to do it, and therefore you have to make a decision.
It's not on the form for a reason.
What are the consequences? Okay, so I hear what you're saying. It's an interesting idea. So you're saying if I say no, there's no relevant more information, and you withhold the information from the government that this person is a man who has sex with men, then you are withholding relevant information. On the other hand, if you go out of your way and say, this is a man who has sex with men, are you sure you're okay with that, Mr. Government? Then you know that this individual is going to have repercussions from a military standpoint.
Right.
And so this is the dilemma. Guys, so let's suppose that we withhold the information. We understand the consequences if we spill the beans. What happens if we withhold this information? What are the consequences? Does everyone think that this is a great idea to withhold this information? I don't think so. Okay. What do you think?
I think you could withhold that.
Okay.
Shouldn't there be a balance between like protecting people's privacy or giving information which actually makes a difference? Like, what if that information make any difference at all?
I like your question.
The problem is that now you're going from the binary decision, do I tell, do I not tell, do I say, do I not say, and you're putting it on your own moral balance. And the problem is that when you put it into your own moral balance, you get into quicksand, and it's very hard to get out. Very hard to try and figure this one out, because your moral balance is different from your moral balance, which is different from your moral balance, which allows, which makes it more difficult to, for you, regardless of whether you're right or wrong, it makes it very difficult.
I just have a question, because I don't know the laws so well and stuff. Are we mandated to, what do we have to document in a chart? I mean, if someone comes for a periodic health exam and you just write, well, and you don't write anything else, you don't write what you asked in the history, you don't write your physical exam, are you allowed to do that? Are you allowed not to write stuff down?
Are you allowed? Okay, do we?
The reality is, and you guys have all done it, and you will continue to do it until the day you retire, a medical note is not a transcription of every word which is spoken in the office. It is humanly impossible and insane to try and document every single solitary thing that takes place in the office. By definition, the chart is a summary, and it is a paraphrase of what's going on in the... It's a summary. So you are omitting information. You will always be omitting information. You, as a doctor, are required to document what is relevant and to document what is considered important from a therapeutic alliance and from a therapeutic benefit. If the patient tells you that he drives a green car or a blue car, that's not medically relevant. So therefore, you're probably not going to document it. If you omit the fact that this person has diabetes, that is medically relevant. And if the college were to investigate, to do a random chart audit and grabs that chart and looks at it, the college would probably be very critical of you, and the college would probably send you for retraining and or suspend your license. And so are you legally required? There's no law book. This isn't a judge who's going to say you are bad. But the judge is the Collège des Médecins. They're the ones who allow you to work. They are your boss. They are the ones who allow you to get your permit. They are the ones who can take away your permit. And the Collège des Médecins, in turn, is representative of the people of the province who presumably are on the same wavelength. Across Canada, every province has their own provincial college, and across Canada, the rules are changing slightly, of course, because every province has slightly different values and has slightly different things that they feel are important, more important and less important. But the general gist of this is the college is the one who has to make sure that you are doing your job as a doctor. If you omit information, you say, patient here for general exam, well, you might get into trouble from a regulatory standpoint. I want to know now, is it sometimes justified to lie on a non-government medical form, such as for insurance or disability? So now we're no longer talking about passport forms, we're no longer talking about the Ministère de Revenus. Now we're talking about Manulife Financial, we're talking about Bell Canada Disability, we're talking about a note for school. These non-government legislative environments. Is it sometimes justified to lie on a non-government medical form? And this is fascinating, because this is not the first time that people have very strong differences between government versus non-government. What do you guys think? You said that this was true.
So you changed your mind from the first to the second.
Yeah.
Why?
I mean, again, it depends on the form. Like, I might not lie on, like, a disability form, but something like, you know, a note for school where I was, like, on the fence about whether or not this person really needed, you know, an extra day off. I might just...
Is that a lie, though?
Well, I mean...
Is it a lie?
In terms of, like... It's not necessarily a true presentation of my judgment of the situation, so in that sense, it's a lie.
So what you're saying is that in your judgment, you feel that this person who is here in your office, say, should go back to school tomorrow, but the person's saying, you know, tomorrow's going to be a nice day and I'm going away, and maybe, you know, if you could give me an extra day there, and you say, well, that sore throat's really bad, isn't it? And so you give the person an extra day off. This is what you're talking about. Kind of.
Yeah.
off and says, you know, by the way, I have an exam on Wednesday. Could you just make it like one or two more days?
Okay.
So I can study. Because I'm sick anyway, so I won't be able to study. So.
What are your thoughts?
What?
No, not yours. Yours. Yes.
Well, I answered no because I'm thinking more of in the insurance context.
Okay.
I think also part of the reason insurance companies and schools and everybody trusts these notes is that they trust the doctors write their honest opinion on these.
Ooh! So they trust, the reason they're asking doctors is because they trust our honest, and they trust our opinions. Okay.
I don't know about that, though, because like my past rotation, all these kids would come in to, I was in Hawaii, they would come in for these school notes, and like after a while it was just silly, a lot of the kids weren't really sick at all, the doctor would just write the note, and the doctor's just like, the school just likes to cover it, if the kid's not there, they have a reason why they weren't there, that they have it in their file. I don't know if it's because like they trust that the doctors are honest, or they know the parents were honest that they brought the kid to the doctor. I'm serious. So it's like, I'm not 100% sure if it's like the school, oh, we really want to know that this 5-year-old kid is truly sick, or if like there's a reason for their absence and their parents like took care of it.
You don't have to say
they're
sick or not, you just say they came to the
doctor.
Like,
you don't have to pose in my rural rotation, it was really funny, because sometimes people come and they're like, they didn't go to work and they say like they feel unwell, but it's like really nothing. And like the doctor is just like, this is really stupid. They should have gone to work or something. And so she has a special stack of like doctor's notes forms. And on this form, it says, patient so-and-so was seen in my medical office, blah, blah, blah. And then it says something along the lines of them wasting medical resources because this is not, I swear to God, because this is not an illness requiring any medical management or anything like that. And this is, so they asked for a doctor's note to say that they came and blah, 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 and this is what she gives them. So she says,
oh, that's nice. She's pleasant.
I don't want to know the name of this doctor. She's so mean.
I couldn't.
Let's take it to the next level.
You just write a note that says, like,
you should have seen my face. I was like, what is this paper? And she's like, yeah, give this to the patients. I didn't want him.
Okay, I answered false, and I think some people who answered true are sort of under the impression, you know, we hear a lot about, like, big corporate insurance companies being evil, which is fine. That doesn't justify you lying on your insurance form. Like, I just think, like, you know, two wrongs don't make a right, is what my point is.
I don't think they're evil, but at the same time, they're honest corporations with the bottom line of trying to make money.
For sure.
They'll do anything they can.
You as a doctor, like, are an advocate for the patient, not the insurance company. So if you're going to lie, if you're going to have, like, a short, even about the smoking, like, one or two cigarettes a week, if that's going to keep your patient from getting insurance to get access to healthcare, then I think...
But I think they are smoking one or two cigarettes a week, so it's their action.
Well, we know that one or two cigarettes is not medically relevant.
I think it is.
What if that person takes a spot of someone who truly doesn't smoke two cigarettes a week?
Well, the insurance companies cover as many people. There's no
spots.
Okay, there are how many people exist in the world? 7 million people. Okay, Manulife Financial has got a whole lot. I say Manulife, but whatever. Pick on any insurance company. They got a whole lot of money. Do you think that they can insure all 7 billion people for all possible medical conditions? No. The whole way in which, guys, the way that insurance companies work is that they have bean counters, they have statistical analyses, they can determine, statistically speaking, how much money do we have to put aside to allot for the people who are coming in. And then they, in turn, create a grid that allow for the distribution and the management accordingly. Do keep in mind, though, that the bottom line of every corporate company in existence is to make money. And that's the bottom line of every corporation, whether we're talking about McDonald's, whether we're talking about Manulife, whether we're talking about a newspaper, it's the same. A whole lot of people would give their hands, yes.
But if these forms are filled out truthfully, then all of the spots for insurance are going to be covered by essentially healthy people that don't actually need that much medical attention, and all the people that actually need care will not be covered by insurance.
Well, here in the province of Quebec, that's why we have Medicare. And we don't care how healthy or sick you are, you're covered by Medicare. Yes.
I think a gray area, because I actually put false, and I think for the smokers, like, smoking puts such a burden on our healthcare system, so I do think that smokers should pay more, because, like, hospitalizations, length of duration, hospital, I mean, there's so many statistics. But a gray area would be, like, let's say you suspect that the patient may have a genetic disease in their family, which you haven't proven, or something like that. You know what I mean? If you suspect that there's something wrong which is not in the form which you could offer up, I think that's a gray area. And that's one that I think I would actually withhold from.
This is a fun fact that in the States, people are sometimes afraid to get tested for HIV because... Now, if you get tested positive, the insurance companies can snatch that result and see that you're positive and up your premiums.
Yeah.
But more than that, if you get tested at all, they presume that you're in a higher risk population and they up your premiums regardless of the result.
Yeah. Are all doctors paying more for that reason?
So, F people who ask doctors for information.
The world is not necessarily a fair place.
Right.
I am not going to tell insurance company X, Y, or Z how to run their business. Mm-hmm. All I can do is run my business as a doctor, and hopefully I will do the right thing. Yes.
That goes on the assumption that you believe that healthcare should be a business in the first place. You know, I mean, you're allowing their companies to basically devise their own guidelines for whatever standard they choose, which can be based on absolutely nothing, in order to, you know, protect and ensure people that actually need healthcare.
Yeah.
And I think that it would be ethically irresponsible not to allow people to access that healthcare, especially when there's another entity with a vested interest in them not you know, covering.
It's not your responsibility. It's the government's responsibility.
That's personal choice. Because the government hasn't taken
responsibility,
right?
I still don't think it's responsibility.
Then you don't have to do it. I will. And I will take the moral hazard.
Into the camera.
And social responsibility.
I'm actually
going
to ask you guys to step away from the U.S. healthcare debate, because the U.S. healthcare debate is extremely charged, and I honestly don't think that there is a true right or wrong answer here. However,
That's why we're here. That's why we're networking in the States. But people have private insurance here too.
There's a million other reasons,
I was just going to say, people here have private insurance too.
Yeah.
It's not just an issue in the U.S. It is an
issue
here as
well. I have private insurance.
I feel
I have Medicare, but I also have private insurance. Yeah.
As
you lie on your form?
As doctors, you should have a right to exert your medical judgment,
even
on a form. If you don't think that something is relevant to their long-term health, and whether it, then maybe you should have the right to omit that information from the form.
But then what if you get on
it's
a patient?
It's your medical judgment.
What if you get on a patient that you like less than another patient? How can you prevent that from impacting your judgment of that person?
Your patient comes to you and says he smokes one cigarette a month. He smokes a joint a month. We'll say one joint a month. Is this clinically relevant? Yes or no? We could debate that. Yes, we could debate that. No, but you document it in the medical chart and you say he smokes a joint a month. Now you get the insurance form that says, does this patient use drugs? If you say no, what do you think is going to happen? The insurance company first is going to say, thank you for that letter, doctor. Can you please send us a copy of your chart? They're going to data mine it when the patient makes a claim. And the person's going to say, hey, look at that. We had erroneous information. Now what do you think the insurance company is going to say? They're not going to crucify you guys. They're going to go back to the patient. And they're going to say, patient, you know, sorry, but there was wrong information. We're not going to pay you for your, but thank you for the premiums. Have a good day. Now what do you think the patient's going to do?
See the doctor.
Patient's going to go out with the one to go after you. He's going to scream bloody murder and say, because of your error that you were trying to cover for me, I lost my insurance. Ooh, that's scary. Yes.
So I actually saw something sort of like that happen. There was this one patient whose son died 4 or 5 years ago. And when they went to collect, you know, the insurance money, there was something, it wasn't a lie in the chart, it was something that was just inaccurate. And the insurance company second-guessed the accuracy of the entire chart based on one little thing.
Yep.
This person lost a significant amount of money.
Yep.
Now, being in not a very stable financial situation, they couldn't afford to hire a lawyer and go to court. And so this is
reality. We have to document properly and accurately. We are a doctor. We're like a sniper. You can't miss. Yes.
I have a question regarding patients who are poor historians.
Yes.
I've seen times where I take down exactly word for word what the patient is saying, put it in my note, and then later I'll look at other notes, you know, like
and it's totally wrong.
The
totally
consult
different.
For RESP and the consult for everybody's got a different version of this story where it's 5 days, 3 days.
Absolutely.
What happens insurance-wise?
Well, what happens is the insurance company, it's a good question. Basically, we are dependent on what the patient tells us. I'm not a police officer. I don't know what the patient sitting in my office is. I don't smoke. He doesn't smell of tobacco. He don't see a cigarette pack in his pocket. I'm going to write down he doesn't smoke. I mean, maybe the guy's a chain smoker and he just like cleaned his mouth up before he walked into my office. I don't know. But I can only do what the patient tells me. And if the patient reports that, that's what I do. If the patient reports different information to different people, to different entities, what will happen is, in reality, what would happen is the insurance company would probably hire an expert and say, okay, there's something weird going on here. And they would just take all the information and try to put it all together. And it is assumed that because we are human, it's normal that we don't always say 100% of the truth 100% of the time. That's the nature of humanity. And the insurance companies accept that. Now, they also want to preserve their own bottom line, too, and if they think that you're trying to defraud them, then they're going to be rather unhappy. Yes?
I mean, these questions are bringing up, like, what I think is kind of like an unfair disconnect, if you will. A patient feels they can go to a doctor and feel safe to give information which is relevant to their health to get the best health care.
And it comes back
and later on, they
get
screwed. So, I mean, let's say someone is not aware that, you know, their insurance company could find this out, or if they apply for insurance later.
Yeah.
I don't think it's such a big deal, but they do this, they do that.
Yeah.
You know, and then if they would, like, wait a second, had I known that insurance could have found that out, of course I would have withheld that information. I don't even think that it's important.
So what you're saying is because we didn't Mirandize our patients before we see them every time.
No, but I think people have this notion that everything is confidential. And even if they can go to the doctor's office and be like, I have something to tell you, is it confidential? Be like, yes, it's confidential unless it's like a risk to yourself or society, whatever. But you're actually lying to the patient there because it's not fully confidential.
It is. It is. When the insurance company contacts you, I get a photocopy of the patient's signature. The patient has authorized the insurance company to contact me. The patient can choose. The patient can choose not to sign that form.
And not to get insurance.
And not to get insurance.
But they didn't realize that when they asked you if it was confidential. Because when they asked you if it was confidential, their understanding of confidential was, it's between you and I.
And nobody else.
Yeah.
I hear you.
So shouldn't you tell patients when they say it's confidential, be like, yeah, and by the way, just so you know, eventually, if you ever apply for insurance, they will
come
ask
back
you
and
to have it.
So do you really smoke?
You should be aware. They're not aware of it. It's not a secret. Why shouldn't you be able to say that to
your
them?
Your point is well taken.
But then you're lying? So then you're withholding? Because that's the question.
Your point is well taken. Yes.
I was just saying, I mean, basically what you're getting at is it's a lack of informed consent is really what it is. Because the patient doesn't understand the ramifications of what they're saying necessarily.
Yeah.
And the problem, though, is that if you were to tell them those ramifications, then you may have destroyed the doctor-patient relationship.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean...
Is lying good? Sorry.
Well, exactly. So, I mean...
It comes back to
the beginning. I mean, I agree with you. I think that patients should know that, and they should have the opportunity to withhold information if they feel that it's going to affect their care. The problem is that if you tell them to do that, then you've given them the right to lie to you, basically, and then they may withhold relevant medical information without knowing.
Do patients lie to their doctors?
Yes.
All the time. Okay. If I omit, we don't have to give them permission to lie. They lie. Okay. If I omit relevant information on a form, I'm not really lying. I think this sort of, we alluded to this, danced around this one a few times.
Everyone has their own definition of relevance.
Oh, well, now it's a gray zone.
Okay. Comments?
Yeah, I think everybody thinks that if you can really consider it relevant, then it's a lie.
Someone disagrees with you.
By Samir and his mom.
No, it wasn't me. This is the exact kind of question I would agree to.
Who claims
true?
I didn't see the word relevant.
Ah! So the operative word here is relevant, and we are talking relevant to the medical context. And if it is relevant, you do have to document it. Even your mind, you don't feel it's relevant, but it really is relevant. That's an error of processing on your part. If you feel it is relevant, you should document it.
it is always good to document the truth. And I choose the words very carefully when I create this sentence. So I totally split 50-50 here. I'm twisting you guys. So what is, why, who, show of hands, who says, yes, it is always good to document the truth? Okay. Who says false? Okay. So why did you guys say false?
I had a patient once who needed a form saying that they went to the doctor. So we wrote something that they had a visit on this day. He came back saying that they needed a reason to fill that. What they were actually there for.
Yeah.
And it was obviously a private issue that they had to get work or school and this is knowing.
Okay.
And the doctor just made something else up.
Okay.
The doctor's
powerful. So the I don't know your scenario. I'm going to make it up. So the guy comes in because he slept with a prostitute the night before. He's worried about having an STI. So he comes in, and you know what? The school shouldn't know that the guy slept with that prostitute the night before, because that has absolutely no bearing whatsoever. Okay. So therefore, in the on this form, he wrote down what? Sore throat.
I don't remember.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And you said that you took the opposite direction. Yes.
I mean, assuming, like, with some assumptions, like, that he was relevant, like, not, like,
yeah.
I wrote he had a red car when he had
yeah.
a car, and, like, documenting the truth as opposed to a lie, not as opposed to, like, omitting.
Okay.
The truth.
Well, I kind of agree with what he said in terms of if a patient comes to you and they're there for some personal reasons and they need to explain to their job or to some other people that they don't need to know, I think you should be able to write something else.
You should be able to write something else because it's not relevant. You were lifting up your hand.
Always and never statements are the easiest to falsify.
Yeah. They are, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah.
But if you can create one scenario in which
scenario.
And you can disprove it, absolutely.
Even a theoretical one.
Yeah. Hypothetical scenario.
False was the easy choice, guys. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Seriously.
Yeah, but I
that was it the right choice.
It was the right choice.
Yeah, your hand is up. Your hand is up.
Sure false.
Yeah. Yeah. Your hand is up.
But I think you can always avoid lying. Like, in this case, you can just write, he came for a private issue.
Yeah.
And they can't question that because it's confidential. And they can't...
Yeah.
And if you say that he has a sore throat, then afterwards, like, they might say, oh, then what was the result of the... Like, they
okay.
might
for
end
example,
up being bad to say that he has a sore throat.
You're in the case room, and the husband... If he finds out that the woman had, this is a true story, had an abortion, he'll freak out and divorce her because that is their culture. So on the board, you are faced with the G and the P and the A.
And you see A1.
And you can go do G, 2, P, 1, A, 0. Or you can do G, 3, P, 1. But hey, I don't know how much knowledge he has, and I know that the board is not altogether obscured. Okay? And it's not important...
Don't write it.
For her, don't write it. So that's a lie.
No, you just. You
how many
write
G's
it.
Do I put? How many
you,
P's
you
do I put?
You just write it on the board.
You're omitting relevant information.
No, this
so
is
the
for
issue.
Their staff.
The issue.
This
the
is
issue.
Their,
yeah.
Interdisciplinary discussion.
I hear what you're saying. And your issue is that information is being made public that shouldn't be made public.
Right.
That's called a breach of confidentiality.
Yeah,
that's not a question of.
It exists in every case.
It does.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, you're right. It does. It does exist. I mean,
yeah.
I was at the Royal Vic. Yeah.
So either, like, you just don't write it on the board and you tell everyone, okay, this is the situation, don't talk about it.
Yeah, that's like having private names, like not the right patient's name. I've seen that.
You don't have to tell the law that you have to have those things on those boards. I mean,
yeah,
no,
that's
the but certainly
it's
if
not
the issue,
always good to document the truth.
The issue,
however.
The issue here, though, is that you want to make sure that you document appropriately, and appropriate documentation would be maintaining patient confidentiality. If you document the truth and then post your medical notes on Facebook for everyone to see, that would be not medically appropriate. In that case, you could spin the same argument and say, well, it's not good to document. Well, actually, no, it wasn't good that you put it on Facebook. So you should,
your issue is addressing a breach of confidentiality, as opposed to now, if the husband's in the room and the wife is in the room and the wife is giving birth, and you say to the wife, have you ever had any abortion? How many times have you been pregnant before? And she says, one, this is my first time that I've ever been pregnant. And you look in the chart and you see G2P0A1. Now it's relevant for you to ask. Now you're on the hot seat, because now it's no longer something that's posted on a board. Now the husband's in your office, and effectively you're going to have to say, well, did you have that abortion or not? Or
the exact situation happens. Think about it, and you just don't say anything in that.
You keep your mouth shut. You let the husband walk out, and then you deal with it. Fair enough. You would
no,
hands. Hands.
General comment. One example doesn't prove the rule. Just because this one may not apply to this question doesn't mean there aren't other scenarios that might apply.
Still, we haven't found one.
It doesn't mean it doesn't exist, though.
No, I think Evan's
no, it's true, though.
No, Evan's example is completely valid. I've had plenty of patients that have come in. Their employers will not accept a letter that does not give a reason. Private medical
really?
Reasons
you're
not does not
give
accept.
You're actually
allowed
not allowed to give a
private.
Reason. In gynecology, there was a woman who came in with abnormal uterine bleeding. And then the resident said, okay, let's write a note. So I started writing the note. She's like, no, you can't write that. I'm like,
well,
okay.
Sure you
you're
can.
You're not allowed to write what the patient's here for. You just tell them that they need a medical leave of absence.
You
they're
can if the patient allows
it.
The patient, if the patient allows it, you can do
you
it.
Can
but
do
how
it?
Could
there
the
is no law that says that you cannot document.
But how could the employer demand to know the medical
leave? It's completely wrong. It's completely wrong, but the patient feels
I feel like it's
so
illegal, not just wrong, illegal.
Guys, these letters, by the way, they don't go to your boss. They go to human resources. They go to the insurance company. They go to the people who are basically paying the bill. Yeah, exactly. And then insurance companies keep coming back.
Like four people who work here.
I answered false on this question just because there's very much of the truth as we were talking, and not all of it is medically relevant.
Yeah.
If there's something that's medically relevant, then yes, that part should be gotcha.
Yeah. You know,
as for Evan's question, I think he was easily right. You know, the patient was here for testing for a medical illness or whatever.
You know, I routinely write, patient here for medical reasons. I work in a rehab center, and I don't say why the patient's there. I say, the patient is admitted to our center between X date and X date for medical reasons.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, it says, centre de réadaptation de toxicomanie on the top. So, I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure it out. But I'm not going to say, this patient is here because he snorts 3 lines of cocaine and shoots up 2 lines of heroin and, you know. I'm not going to write that down. I'm just going to say, patient is here for medical reasons. I have never had... On the little notes, I have never had anyone come back to me and say that was insufficient. Give me more information. That has never occurred to me. Now, I would argue that the correct answer here is false, and it's actually not to do with what anyone is saying. The key operative word is good. It is not always good. It can be detrimental to document the truth. That, to me, is. We're hitting a raw nerve here. We are doctors. We're supposed to help the patients. That tells nicely into this one here. The truth must be documented, even if it is at the detriment of my patient. Now you know that this is going to be used against them. These are real questions, by the way. These are real scenarios that you're going to be faced with. Right now, you've got a clicker, and it's a heck of a lot easier with a clicker than it is with a patient who's angry and pissed off at you in front of you.
This is
in
a
context
when
the truth is relevant.
The truth is medically relevant.
It's like a form whether he should be driving or not.
The truth is medically relevant. The patient says if you document the truth, there are going to be consequences about you documenting the truth. Somebody's on the fence. Thank you. Some people have said false to this question. I would like to know who said false, and I would like to know why. Yes.
Because I don't really understand the question.
Okay.
I need a situation to respond to this. You know, I can't really just make people like a general.
Okay. So I'm going to give you. I'm going to give you a statement in which this is the OSCE scenario that was run. So the 45-year-old truck driver who smokes 1 or 2 joints a night, who has financial stress, who has sleep disturbance, and who has mood disturbance, and comes to you with a medical form. You as a physician know that it's written down substance use disorder, yes or no, and based on your information, you meet the criteria of substance use disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Do you document that yes or no? If you say yes, you know, and the patient knows that he's going to lose his license. And if he loses his license, he's not going to drive. And his financial stress, which was this big, has now become this big. Okay. This is a very real scenario.
So, of course. So that's medically relevant, in my opinion, pretty obvious. You would document that.
Would you?
Is it a safety-sensitive position?
Exactly.
Yeah?
Yeah, so he's putting himself and others at risk. Yeah.
What about the person? Does anybody disagree with this?
Well, I have one.
Yeah?
In Peru, it's illegal to get married if you have HIV.
Okay.
But I just worked in Peru, and so I can't help but, you know.
Fair enough.
Okay. So every time that a person wants to get married, they have to go to the physician, and they have to get a form filled out.
That says, I certify that this person's HIV negative.
They have to say, this person is healthy in all the relevant manners to the state.
Yeah.
Okay. And so if you want this person to be able to get married to the person who, there they are, maybe they're both HIV positive, okay? So there's no risk of transmitting to each other. They'll take all the right drugs and they'll prevent vertical transmission. What do you do?
But do you know if the spouse, like, is aware of that HIV or not?
I'm telling you, they both have HIV.
No, you're living in a country.
Yes.
You follow the rules of that country. You don't like it, move.
It's a ridiculous attitude.
Knowing the laws of the land and for respecting the laws of the land. You are also responsible for using your own professional judgment as your own professional order and doing your own right stuff. The problem is that the people are the one who both represent the government and who represent the college, and so you end up with this very... From your context, that sounds very foreign to me. I wouldn't want to do that. I wouldn't want to be a physician there. But you know what? If I was born in Peru and I lived in Peru, maybe I would have a different perspective. I don't know. I'm from Montreal. I grew up in Montreal. I understand the Montreal way of doing things. I don't even understand the Toronto way of doing things.
You shouldn't impose your culture
on
that.
I know Montreal. I don't know other parts of the world.
So this is what I said at the beginning, is that every choice you make has a moral hazard to yourself, and you have to be either willing to accept that or not accept it, and that's your personal choice. So in that case, depending on what the consequences were for filling out that form incorrectly, I may or may not do it, right?
So let us suppose, for example, that the consequence of incorrect
filling
out the
patient wants,
you will lose, you'll get your license suspended. You'll get your license suspended.
Well, if it's 100% sure thing, then of course I wouldn't do it.
Okay.
I mean, that's my personal level.
You may
level
get your license suspended. If that year they happen to, I don't know, audit you.
Exactly.
Ethical
versus legal, exactly.
They're
not the same thing.
But in your consideration of what is ethical to do, you're also considering the consequences to yourself.
And to your patient, more importantly. The patient, right, wants me to fill out the form, and they really want to get married, then it's in the best interest of my patient. If I find that it's not a significant risk to myself or to the patient for whatever consequences I'll do, and they're okay with that, then I would probably fill out the form. Right? You know,
I think it's important to fight back against something that you disagree with,
exactly.
And not by, like, leaving the country.
not by lying to the government either.
No, but exactly. I don't think
to another level.
Like, your role is not to play doctor and government at the same time and determine what laws are reasonable and what aren't. If you want to fight back against that, you have to do it in a different way. And go into politics, maybe.
Right.
And just choose not to fill out that form.
I agree.
Because you don't want to lie. And you also don't want to give them the death sentence.
I agree with you, but you're assuming that my motivation was to fight against the government. My motivation was actually just to help my patient do what they wanted to do.
But you're undermining the government.
But that's a side effect. That's not my primary motivation, right? That's not what I'm trying to do. What I'm trying to do is have my patient have the best life that they can have.
Can I speak? Can
yes.
I speak?
I give you permission.
There's a correct answer here. The correct answer is number one. you as a physician, ultimately, you're the one in the office, and the only two people in the office is you and the patient. But the correct answer that you will be held to is one. The truth must be documented. This is not a question, this is a statement. The truth must be documented, even if it is at the detriment of your patient. Think very hard before you deviate from that path. Yes?
I had a question for you about the example that you gave about the truck driver and substance abuse.
Yeah.
If you document the truth and they lose their license, if they go through a program, substance abuse program,
yeah,
can they regain that license?
Absolutely.
So then it's not a detriment to the patient, ultimately.
Sure it is.
Well, first of all, those patients know from their jobs that they're not allowed to do drugs and that they probably have urine drug screens anyways. For truck drivers, in the U.S. DOT, yes. Mm-hmm. U.S. DOT federal guidelines oblige drivers to go through urine drug testing. I do that all the
time.
If you're Canadian and you drive on U.S. soil, you are subject to U.S. laws of the land.
Okay.
You cannot speed. You can't drive drunk. You got to wear your seatbelt, and you got to pee. You got to pee clean. If you're a commercial truck driver. Now, if you're a Canadian driver and you only drive from Montreal to Toronto, and you're Bill and Bob's moving company, and you drive an 18-wheeler from Montreal to Toronto and back, and you never cross the U.S. border, what the laws in the U.S. don't apply to you. And the Canadian laws, it's anything goes. In Quebec, if you have a class one permit or a class one permit which allows you to drive, the gatekeeper, shall we say, is every 2 years you get an M28 form that you see your doctor and they fill it out and they say, so, you have any diabetes? So, you ever have any epilepsy, any seizures? Can you see okay? You hear okay? And so on. Smoke weed? That's the gatekeeper function. You can say that's a good system or a bad system, but that's the system, be it good or bad. If I am requested to fill a form, I should fill it. Now, there's a few caveats on this. We are assuming that you actually have the consent of the patient to fill it out. And we are also assuming that you have the competency to fill it out. Don't ask me if the patient should get a metallic or a porcine a valve replacement because I'm not a cardiothoracic surgeon. I cannot fill out that form. Clearly, I must have consent of the patient and I must have the competency tools to fill it out. And with this in mind, I am being requested to fill out a form. I should fill it, true or false? Who said false? Okay, why? Okay. I'm a patient. Who else said false? Why?
You should be allowed to refuse.
You should be allowed to refuse. Sorry, you are allowed to refuse, but here's the thing. If you are requested, this actually shouldn't be such a controversial question. If you have the competency and the skill set to answer the question, and you have the consent of the patient to answer the question, and the patient is saying, can you please fill out this form for me?
Would you not do that? I guess the concept
you should fill it out.
I misunderstood the question.
A lot of doctors charge to fill out those forms, and if they don't pay, they don't fill them out. So.
That's right. It's not a Medicare-covered thing.
Right.
If you walk into my office, and in a private office, here in the CLSC is different, but if you walk into my private office, and you say, hey, doc, I got to fill out my M28 form, I want $40.
So doctors all the time refuse to fill out forms unless you pay.
Well, we assume that...
The forms that the CLSC Metro has for like I am missing school or work doesn't have a box where it says this is not a medically relevant. This is medically relevant. This is kind of medically relevant. This is medically relevant, but I didn't actually see him during the illness. So if I don't think that he has a medically relevant reason to miss work, then I won't fill out the form.
You won't fill out that form, but you can write it on a prescription on the side.
Yeah, well, it's this form. I'm being asked to fill out this form.
Okay, yeah. What I would do in that context is, okay, when you're faced with a false, with a false decision, where the correct answer is none of the above. So in that context, if I was asked, I would circle both, I would exit out, and I would write down underneath. And that way, whoever's at the other end of the receiving end of this letter understands what the story is.
I was just, I guess, biased by our previous discussion. If there's a form that you don't agree with,
right,
like, should this person be allowed to marry because they're because whatever their HIV status is, then you could just neglect to fill it out.
Okay.
And combat or fight that battle a different way.
Fair enough.
But like, and I guess it's you still, the word should there versus must. That's maybe what I misread.
I must honor my patient's requests when forms are filled with respect to content. So now the patient says, but you must write this down or you can't write that down.
In other words, like I had a heart attack 10 years ago, don't put that on my insurance form, that kind of thing.
That would be one example.
Like basically they'd be filling out their own form.
Here, I already filled it out for you, Doc. Just sign it.
I get a lot of patients who fill out their own forms. Doc, all you gotta do is sign it. Thank you. I'm glad that do people have any questions about this?
No.
There may be times when I fill out a form for my patients and he or she will not be happy.
That's how much you charge.
Ouch! $20 for a form, $40 for one of these, $100 for an extended form, $150 to $200 for an insurance billed to the insurance company. Those are the standard rates.
Really?
Awesome. Yeah, I like the insurance company.
those are the standard rates. Yeah, you know, sometimes patients are going to be pissed off with you. They're going to say really nasty things to you, and then they're going to storm out of the office. That happens. So we've chatted a whole lot about forms. What is a form? A form is a request for information. It's a request for information which is validated by a doctor or a trusted individual. And that's a request for accurate information. It's also a request, by the way, this is why the forms, why they're asking you to fill out the forms and not the patient to fill out the forms. Because it is a request for a validated by a doctor. There's a certain validity once it goes through the physician's office. It is a request for information with which an action will be taken. Something's going to happen. There's a reason why you're filling out the form. Something is going to happen as a result. What can be taken? It can be in issues of employment. It can be issues of private insurance, issues of permits, payment of insurance claim, off work, return to work issues. The list can go on and on in terms of what actions can be taken. What are the cases? Mr. S. We're going back to now away from binary dichotomy, true, false statements, and now we're going to go on into actual clinical cases. Mr. S. is a 48-year-old man. He is in your office today. He meets the diagnostic criteria for major depression. He has functional limitations. Now, this is the operative word. A functional limitation is something that prevents the individual from actually working. It's not sufficient to have a diagnosis. There's a lot of depressed people who go to work, but you must have a functional limitation which impairs your ability to work. Based on your patient evaluation, the patient meets the diagnostic criteria of major depression. He has functional limitations. He's unable to work. He says, I need a note for off work, Doc. And he wants help for his treatment of depression. He gives you a disability claim form to be filled. So now the question is, do you fill this form? Yeah, you fill the form. All right. Now, so you fill the form, the guy's off work. So on follow-up visit, he says he started the medication. He gave him Prozac. He says, you know what, I'm taking the Prozac and it's helping me a little bit better. And then you ask him a little bit more questions and you ask him about his alcohol because you forgot to ask him about alcohol last time. And this time he tells you that he drinks 10 to 15 drinks per day for the past year. And he also smells of alcohol. And his appointment's at 10 o'clock this morning. He gives you a follow-up disability claim form to be filled. Okay? Any questions? You know where this is going. How do you fill this form? Do you fill the form? Diagnosis depression compliant with treatment. Do you fill the form depression complicated by possible alcohol abuse? Do you fill the form diagnosis alcohol abuse with depressive features?
Wait, how long was the drinking?
A year.
For the past year.
And the depression?
4 months. He's been slowly getting more and more bummed out, more and more like his work isn't happening. His mood has gone down, his sleep has gone down. He doesn't have any interest in life. he's noticed some weight loss also, and he doesn't have any enjoyment in life anymore.
And we're sure that is it possible alcohol use? Is he abusing?
Well, he tells you that he's drinking 10 to 15 alcoholic drinks per day for the past year. And it's at 10 o'clock in the morning, and he smells of alcohol in his breath. Yes, you had a question.
They both start at the same time?
His alcohol consumption started a year ago. And there's no real start time. Okay, his official start time is when you fill out the form on the last visit. But if you ask him clinically, he tells you that life has been getting progressively worse and worse for some time now.
Can we do number two, but without the possible?
You can do number one, you can do number two, or you can do number three. And some of you are still not are all still on the fence here.
I want
here.
None of the above.
I just don't understand what you didn't ask last time.
Because I forgot.
Why?
I was in a rush. The guy walked in, he was crying, he was sad. I slipped my mind, I didn't ask him about alcohol.
Yeah.
Does it happen that we forget to ask relevant questions? Yeah, it happens all the time. Come on, guys, no abstainers. Let's go.
Aria.
We're up to 15.
Jeweler.
16, all right. What do people say? So no one said one. A bunch of you said two, and a bunch of you said three. To be fair, you do not have enough clinical information to distinguish between two or three. However, what is interesting is that none of you said one, which presumably was what you wrote down on the first time that you came in. But doc, you can't say anything about my alcohol. If you do, my insurance won't cover me.
Stop drinking.
Now what do you do? Now what do you do? The form. None of you are still saying number one. You're still putting in this alcohol bit. Now, you had a question, though, because you said, can we put number two without the alcohol abuse?
No,
what did you mean?
Without the possible, like depression complicated by alcohol abuse.
Okay, right. Well, the issue is that we actually, again, I haven't given you enough information to...
Yes, but we said you meant the criteria for depression, so I didn't see depressive features.
But the criteria of depression by the DSM is say if it's not, if there, it can't be explained by alcohol, by any kind of substance abuse or illnesses.
If he was depressed before he started drinking, then he only had depression.
We didn't say that.
You don't know.
We don't know.
Yes.
You don't know.
Like
here's the thing.
In terms of the chronology,
sometimes it's very clear. In this clinical context, it's especially vague, and most of the time, unfortunately, it is vague. the issue here is do we float the alcohol balloon to the insurance company?
Yeah.
That's basically the bottom line here. And you. You could get 10 doctors in a room and some would say 2 is the correct answer, some would say 3 is the correct answer. But doc, you don't understand. You see, I'm already scheduled to start an inpatient alcohol treatment program. If I lose my insurance, I'll have to stop treatment and I will go back to work, something I can't do now. And as an aside, you choose to verify his claim. You phone up the rehab center. They say, oh, yeah, actually, it's Friday afternoon. And yeah, he's Mr. S, he's scheduled to come into our center Monday morning. And yeah, absolutely. Yes.
I think there might be a hole in this question, or I don't understand it. If his insurance is covering an inpatient alcohol treatment program, how is it that they won't cover him if he's drinking alcohol?
It won't cover his alcohol treatment program. If you come to Dollar Cormier, we're a public center, right?
Yeah.
Who knows that you're coming into Dollar Cormier?
Okay, you're saying they don't know.
They don't know. All they know is that you're at home.
Okay.
All they know is that you're at home taking Prozac, getting slowly better.
Okay, I understand what you're saying. So they don't know that he's being treated for alcohol abuse.
That's right. Dollar Cormier, you have a Medicare card, you come in, you go there, you go here, or Foster Pavilion, or, you know, you
right.
Whatever.
They just get the bill with the name of the center on it.
No, they don't even get that.
Oh, they don't? Okay.
They don't even get that. It's all around you. You have your little healthcare card, click, click.
Oh, sorry,
no,
I thought...
You
have
the insurance
private
deserves
insurance,
deserves to know, though. I think
this
is...
Okay, so
know.
Insurance... Okay, let's...
Insurance
yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So let's clarify this. This is work insurance.
Okay.
This is off work insurance. This is somebody hypothetical example. I work for Bell Canada. I have an alcohol drinking problem. I have to stop working. So when I stop working, I don't get paid because I'm not at work, right? The problem is that I'm sick. So I have a group insurance plan, so I get a disability insurance. So the disability insurance pays me while I'm at home taking my Prozac to get better so that I can return back to work. The problem is that the disability insurance company says, we will not pay you if your disability is secondary to an alcohol or drug problem. We do not recognize that as a DSM diagnosis. In fact, we call that an Access 4 disorder, not an Access 1 disorder. Now, let's go one step further, which, by the way, happens quite a bit. So what I do is, or what doctors do, is you write down and you say, well, the guy's depressed. Well, then the disability insurance company says, oh, Mr. Smith is depressed, so therefore we're going to pay our payout the way that we'd normally pay a payout to Mr. Smith or whoever. But in reality, as an aside, they go to their rehab center, they get fixed, they get finished. They say, wow, I feel better, I think better, I'm not depressed anymore because I'm not drinking anymore, thank you very much. And they get back to work. It's a win-win-win-win-win situation, but it means that you guys have to lie on that form, yes.
So I think in this situation is very different from the other situation we said, like maybe some use in the past, whatever. Guy clearly has a major alcohol problem.
He knows it. He's arranged for treatment.
The insurance company deserves to know. I definitely think they deserve to know. Why should they be insuring someone? What could be done and advised to this guy is I think that there's in the Canadian Charter of Human Rights that the company that he's working for cannot just fire him. They actually have to allow for him to have some rehabilitation.
Yeah. So you cannot fire an individual based on a diagnosis. If the boss finds out you're HIV positive and says, no, I don't want you, you're fired. You can't do that. That's illegal. The insurance company is not obliged to pay you. So, for example, if I said, you know what, if I went up to my boss and I wanted to be totally on the up and up, and I said, boss, I got an alcohol problem and I'm going to a rehab center next week. I'm not going to be in for the next 2 weeks. And my boss knew that and my boss was okay with that. And he says, you know, David, you're not going to get paid for disability. And I said, I don't care about disability insurance. I got enough savings. I don't care about this. You just, like, don't fire me. I'm just away without pay for 2 weeks. And my boss says, okay, he rubber stamps that, and I go to my treatment center. Everyone's happy. Win-win-win-win-win situation. The problem is that I don't get paid during that 2 weeks. And most people don't have a lot of savings to last while they're...
There are consequences to people's actions,
yeah.
Though, right? 50 drinks a day.
If he can't go to work in his current state, he got no choice.
But often these insurance companies, it's like group insurance, no?
Yeah.
So, like... You know, my coworker is an alcoholic, and my premium is gonna go up because he's being paid for his depressive episode. But really, he's an alcoholic.
Yeah.
So I'm getting screwed.
Yeah.
Because his doctor lied. Like that's not
fair. Is
that fair?
No.
No, but I'm in
funding
programs for rehab.
Yeah. No, it's a public rehab center. You don't have to pay out of pocket to go to there are private ones where you can pay $10,000 a week. But there are public ones that are available, like Bellar Cormier, where I work. And the issue is not that the individual has to pay for the treatment. The issue is that while the guy is not physically doing his job, he's not physically getting paid. And he wants his disability payment. He wants his disability payment. Yes?
Is he going to an in-treatment center?
Treatment center. I don't know.
I was doing my rural rotation, the family doctor I was working with was saying that when patients who have depression feel that they can't work, it's okay to give them a couple of weeks off, but you shouldn't give them an extended period of time, that it's actually good for them to continue their activity,
right.
That they should continue. So say the follow-up appointment was, like, I don't know, 3 weeks later because you wanted to see, you know, you gave them an SSRI and they should be acting by that point, three or four weeks later. So it's already been about a month.
Mm-hmm.
Why should he still have time off work anyway? So I don't see.
Clinically, you feel that they still have functional limitations. Yes.
I'm kind of confused as to, in your position, like, are you sure that he's an alcoholic, therefore he's depressed, or that he's depressed and therefore he drinks? So if you're not
sure, then you can just stare toward
the side of the patient.
That is the split between point two and point three. And, you know, you have this debate until the cows come home. Just because, technically speaking, if you go by the book
It is impossible for any person to be depressed, to meet a diagnostic criteria of depression, while they are consuming alcohol. Technically. Now, in reality, are you allowed to have an ingrown toenail and have pneumonia? Yeah. Are you allowed to have gastroenteritis and have chlamydia? Yes. Are you allowed to have be depressed and drink too much alcohol? Yes. So there's a distinction. There's the technical, but then there's the clinical reality, and the clinical reality goes into the gray zone of what's called dual diagnoses. But that's not a talk for today, which is why both point two and point three are up there and are possible answers that a physician could give. And really, it depends. You could toss a coin and see which ones physicians would tend to side towards. But the real question here is whether or not you reveal that there's alcohol issues going on. That's the underlying issue. And I want to see another eight of you answer this question.
I didn't see it.
I changed my answer.
Two more. Interesting. 13% of you said depression compliant with treatment. Now that you have confirmed that he has an alcohol problem, that he is seeking help, that you've said number one. Who says one? Why?
Well, just because when you said it, it's win-win-win. It's true. And it's not a lie.
It's a lose for the insurance company.
He's compliant with all the treatments. He's seeking his Prozac, and he's going to go to...
Are you withholding relevant medical information?
Yes.
Who's else says yes? Who says one for this one? More than one person said one, because 13% of you said one. That's like two or three of you.
It's two.
It's two of us.
Okay. Who is the other person? Come on, guys.
I changed my answer from three to two. I didn't choose one.
Between three and two, you guys can you can waffle. That's okay. Number one, though, is withholding medically relevant information. And that's critical. It would be incorrect to fill out number one. As much as the patient's going to be pissed off at you, as much as the patient may suffer harm as a result, you must fill out number one. Mrs. W. She's a 22-year-old woman, and she presents to an evening walk-in clinic with 24 hours of diarrhea. She has multiple bouts last night and this morning, and now it seems resolved. She's no vomiting, otherwise she's well. On physical exam, everything's normal. Are there any questions so far?
So she's sick based on her story is what you're telling me.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. She's had massive diarrhea for the past 24 hours.
Is it bloody or...
Non-bloody. Oh, can you write me a note for school? I missed my exam today. You need this account. So, what do you write?
Take a more thorough history.
Okay, you take a more thorough history and you'll find out. What else would you like to know?
I don't know, I just wanted to see, is this having a real impression? Does this person have a gastro or are they faking it?
How good is it of an actor is she, is what you're asking? Do you believe it?
I guess you have to see. If you're feeling like you believe it or this is totally plausible, then yeah, I don't know. But if it seems like a person's faking it.
Well, there you go. How many of you have ever seen a patient with gastroenteritis? How many of you have ever seen a patient actually have active diarrhea right there in the office?
I mean, we kind of did, actually.
It's not an issue.
Okay, so you guys, you can fill out the form. My apologies to you. So, what do you guys write? One, two, please excuse Mrs. W. from her exam today. She had diarrhea. Mrs. W. was seen this evening for medical reasons. Please excuse Mrs. W. from her exam today for medical reasons, and I cannot confirm a diagnosis, so this is what you would say. I cannot confirm a diagnosis, so I cannot write you a note.
What time of day is it?
This is evening. This is the evening walking time.
Has she been fine today?
She had multiple bouts of diarrhea this morning, she was just basically all afternoon, and now she's pepping up, and she says, oh, right, I need another...
for school. So she comes to the walk-in clinic.
She's been having diarrhea and vomiting for 48 hours.
24 hours. Yeah, last night and this morning.
She's well.
She's not dehydrated. She doesn't have any orthostatic changes. She doesn't have like sunken cheeks. She.
No, but I mean, like, she doesn't seem even like a bit fatigued or something. Like,
yeah, she's a little bit tired. You know. You guys all look a little bit tired, so you know. Not always. Not always. Three more. Because one of them stuck there. We lost one guy.
It's
me.
One more.
It's me.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Make your choice.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Choose your destiny.
15. One more guy. Come on.
Is there more than this?
Choose your destiny.
Commit. Okay, here we go. So, none of you said number one. A whole lot of you just gave a non-committal, was seen as a medical reason. Some of you said to excuse her for exam for medical reasons, and none of you said four. You know, whether you choose two, there is no right or wrong answer here. Now, whether you choose two or three, both of those would probably be the easy road to go down. Two is probably the safer road to go down. If you felt that the girl was really convincing you and looked sick, you know, you say number three. Number two is probably the safer answer. Yes.
Three strikes me as you know, I'm the doctor. I'm not the examiner.
Yeah.
So all I can say is that she was seen this evening for medical reasons, and here's what the likely diagnosis is. I can't say, like, please give her a second chance to take the exam. That's not my...
No, and nobody will ever ask you to do that, by the way. Nobody will ever ask you to do that. I had a question where a patient came to me and said, Doc, I need my... I need you to write a note that said that 5 years ago when I was in school that I had to drop out for medical reasons. And because I didn't get that note 5 years ago, now the university is coming after me and wants me to pay back tuitions. But I want to have my tuition basically canceled. I want to cancel that semester for medical reasons. And I flipped back in my chart 5 years ago, and I have absolutely no documentation. I mean, there was like a depression or there's something else going on. There was no reason why I never made any comments, say, off work or off school. So I said, look, the best that I can do is I can write you a note and I can say, I saw you on this date and this was your diagnosis. I saw you on this date and this was your diagnosis. It is possible that given these diagnoses that you may have had difficulty in school. Good luck. That was what I wrote, which was factually correct. It was the most that I could do. I gave the letter to him. And he came back to me a month later and said, Doc, thank you very much. They accepted the letter, they put it on the file, and everything got taken care of. Thank you very much. So sometimes you don't necessarily have to commit yourself 100%. You can just, if you lay the cards down, sometimes other people do their jobs too. Yes, you had a...
I don't think it really matters anymore, but I was just going to say, I have been asked to do that. But I think it was more like, now that I think about it, it was more medically proper to state the difference in the limitation. The person just had surgery, so therefore they couldn't do physical labor at their job. So we wrote them a note saying that they should be excused from all physical duties, but they're still allowed to sit at a desk and do something. So, I mean, it's a little bit different, though. It's not as...
Mrs. T, I mean, this is not a clicker question. She's off work for major depression. She's been planning for treatment. She's in your office. You know her. She's currently in partial remission. Residual symptoms remains. She stays at home most of the day. She reads. She watches the... surfs the web. Watches TV. She seems to be today for completed return to work. The background is the following. She hates her work. She hates her boss. But she likes her colleagues. She really does like her colleagues. Multiple colleagues, she reports, have quit or gone on disability because the place is so unfriendly. She would like to return to work. She tells her, I want to go back to work, but she's worried about relapsing into depression. What do you guys... What would be an appropriate course of action to take? This is not a clicker question.
An option would be maybe to not go back full time yet. Still have some kind of recovery period.
So you're saying go back part time?
Sure.
Okay.
Look for another job at the same time.
Look for another job.
If
if she wants to go back to work and try it, I think she should try it. Different rituals like coping, how she feels with the situation, counseling things, like where we follow up. She wants to try it.
Was her boss a large element of her major resident
business? Yeah. This is based on a real scenario, by the way.
Are there other jobs available for her?
It would be hard. She's looking.
But even if
it's a tough economy.
But even if they're in the same company, is there maybe something she can do? Like,
she's got her eyes open. She's actively looking.
I think if she's better, she should attempt going back to work. It's not your job to, you know,
hold her back.
Yeah, no, to make sure that she gets paid while she doesn't work because she doesn't like her job. A lot of people don't like her job, and you know, yes, she has depression. She is in partial remission.
I agree. I mean, if she is, like, especially if she has tools to cope, if she is, you know, whether it be family members or you've set up consults with various people, and I like the idea of a progressive return to work.
I think she needs to go back to work, too. She's going to get more depressed if she just stays at home all the time. She needs a purpose. She needs, yeah. But also then, yeah, you know, give her tools to cope and book a close follow-up. To be able to counsel her with how to, like, real life, she has to go on with it, but give her ways to cope with her stresses.
They basically covered it, but I think one of the important things is that she says she wants to return.
Yeah.
And for people that are depressed, the interest in actually going back to work is probably a good thing.
Yeah.
So if you can find a way to help her do that, it's probably going to be a good thing.
The issue here is that work can be therapeutic, can be anti-therapeutic too, but work can be therapeutic, and somebody who is depressed, who is off work, who says, I don't see myself going back to work, sometimes giving a gentle nudge can be useful to get the person to move forward and get the person, as in the context of gentle or slow progressive return to work, this would be sometimes a good thing, as well as treating the underlying depression, go for psychotherapy or whatnot, go for job counseling. Or Mr. G is seen in an outpatient drug treatment program. He's evaluated for dependence to cannabis. Currently, he's under significant financial stress and is working two jobs, one in Montreal and one in the South Shore. I can tell you that one is in the East End and one is in Long Bay. He has multiple, this is a real case, he has multiple losses. He describes it as a year from hell. When I explore it further, loss of wife, illness, family, it's like... The story doesn't end, but all the bad stuff is going on in this year. Despite his year from hell, he is holding down two full-time jobs, one of which where he works like 8 hours, and then he goes and drives like crazy, and then he works another 7 hours, and he's under a lot of financial stress also. He states he smokes marijuana while he drives, and he's compliant with the treatment services that he's receiving. What are your guys' thoughts? What are your thoughts?
He shouldn't be driving.
What are your thoughts? Yes.
Does he have a form?
He doesn't have a form.
Who gets those? Like, who has to fill out those forms?
Who has to fill them out?
No, I mean,
well,
who gets requested to fill out those forms? Okay, so the government will sometimes do them at random. Typically, when you get your driver's license renewed every year, there's a little boxes on the back that says, you know, has your medical condition changed? And if you check off a whole bunch of boxes, then the government's going to send you this form and says, okay, there's something wrong. Maybe you should see a doctor to make sure that you're good to drive.
Okay.
If you say, I wear glasses, like me, I've never gotten one of these forms, and probably the first time that I'll get one is when I'm 65 or 70, when the first form gets issued. And then they have certain time limits, so like age, again, it's either 65 or 70, and then 70 and 75, 80, and then like every few years after that. Also, if you have special permits, if you're an ambulance driver, if you're a fire truck driver, if you're if you drive 18-wheelers, semis, if you drive a city bus, then you get these forms like on an annual basis to make sure that things are okay. Then you have to, for those professional drivers, you have to go an extra step. They like this more in detail.
Okay.
What do you do? Do you proactively? He's just coming in saying, "Hi, doc, I'm here. This is the story. And I want to know, like, do I need antidepressants? Should I take any pills or not? Or, you know, like, what sort of therapy should I do, inpatient, outpatient? What do you think, doc? And this is the information you acquire during the interview. Do you pick up the phone and say, I'm going to phone the SAQ, the driver's license people, and say, guess what, Mr. G is smoking weed? Or are you happy that he's seeking treatment and is compliant with treatment service? Yes, you got a question.
So what's compliance to treatment?
He's meeting his therapist once a week, and we have documented events. When I'm reading the clinical notes, it appears that there is, like, sometimes it's the same notes, like a broken record going on. It actually sounds like he's really getting involved and he's opening up. And he tells me, he says, Doc, you know, I have gone through such a year from hell that right now I have lost my ability to try and play the system. I have lost my ability to try to play a game. Right now, I am naked in front of you, and you are going to fix me. You are the doctor. My life is in your hands. I throw my cards on the table. Fix me.
So
I'm not even going to try to be deceptive at this point, because I'm just so burnt out and so fried up here.
But he is still smoking, even though he's compliant.
Yes. The program allows that you smoke?
Absolutely. On an outpatient basis, this particular program is designed for harm reduction, such that if you, let's say, you as an individual, you smoke your weed and you say, look, I'm a med student, I can't play, go to an outpatient treatment program. We know that within the first hour, we're not going to cure you like that. But what we are going to do is we are going to allow you to continue with your follow-up. Let's look at what else is going on in your life. Let's try to fix all those other things that are going on in your life, and look at that as you go through the therapy. You realize that, wait, maybe you can smoke less and smoke less and smoke less, and the ultimate goal is to not smoke. That is the way this model is, this program is set up.
Just one other question: are you required to tell the SAQ if you have a patient who drives drunk? Tell you, are you is that in the job description?
You,
or is that the right thing to do?
You as a physician have a duty to confidentiality to the individual. You cannot just post your clinical notes on Facebook. You as a physician also have a duty to the public, and you must report imminent dangers to the public, which is under that umbrella that if you see a homicidal patient or a suicidal patient, you can say, you know what, I'm phoning the police and you're going to a psychiatric unit right now against your will, and yes, I'm going to phone the police. If you have a patient who is presenting imminent danger in that they are telling you, I actively drive intoxicated, you actually have, in Quebec, you have the legal protection to phone up the SAC.
The protection?
You have the legal protection, which means that if the patient then tries to sue you for breach of confidentiality, if I phone up your mother and say, guess what, Billy's smoking weed, you could sue me for breach of confidentiality. If I phone up the SAC and say, guess what, Billy's smoking weed, the SAC will, you could try to sue me, but the SAC will defend me. Because I have the legal protection. In other provincial jurisdictions, you have an obligation. In Quebec, you have a protection.
Oh, okay.
And it allows you to phone up the SAC. You are not required to phone up the SAC. Now, some people look at these laws and say, wow, Quebec is so progressive and allows the judgment of the physician. Other people are very bitter and says, wait, you're telling me that I'm the one who has to take the fall now? Why can't the government just take the responsibility off of my shoulders by obliging me to do this?
That's the case for all imminent dangers? Like, homicide as well?
If your clinical judgment is such that the person is in imminent danger,
then you're obligated.
You would be wise to do so. If you breach confidence, you would be wise to. Obligated is a very strong word. Dr. Motav, do you have any comments about what I've just said?
No.
Do you agree with what I'm saying?
That's exactly it.
Okay, so we have the freedom.
If there's an imminent danger,
but that's
if it's imminent,
If the person's saying I'm depressed, but I'm not really depressed,
is it,
well,
is it
I want to kill myself. I have my cord, but I don't. I'm not going to kill myself this week.
So, it's
so
like,
is it imminent or is it?
I guess I'm getting at, is it imminent if he smokes right after he leaves your office and starts driving? Is he putting the public at?
Right, but I mean, I don't feel like I'm really like professionally competent to make that decision.
Are you going to be in the car beside him watching him drive? No,
of course not.
Sorry,
I don't know. I mean, I.
You call the CMQ.
Drive safe.
Okay, okay, okay. We got a vote to phone a friend. So we
exactly.
You
50-50.
You phone the you phone that's next. So you got your 50-50. There you go. We have a request to phone the CMQ.
But like, would you feel comfortable driving on the road beside him? If not, then
sometimes there's people who smoke weed every day and drive safely. Yeah. I think.
But the evidence shows that it's an impairment. Drive.
you could. I don't want to drive with you.
No, but if you were driving on the road and you knew that other people were drunk or high while driving, like, it makes you...
It's dangerous.
It's dangerous.
Yeah.
What about the little girl who's going to die?
Yeah, let's give a baby a boat.
Okay, so we phone the College de Médecins and we say, College de Médecins, help me out. What do I do?
That's
the college, because they have a 24-hour hotline. So the doctor on call phones me over back and says, here's the deal. According to the government and according to the Code de Déontologie du Québec, you have the right to phone up the SAC. If you feel that there's a danger going on here, you can phone the SAC. I did phone the CMP for this one. This is a real case. And you have the legal protection if you choose to phone and report him. The Collège des Médecins is not going to tell you report them or don't report them because the Collège des Médecins isn't in the doctor's office. They're not the ones performing the exam. You are the professional. You are the ones doing the doctor's office. You are the ones with the clickers in your hands, and you are the ones who are going to answer this question. Do you report or do you not report? Keeping in mind that he doesn't have an M28 form in front of you.
And keeping in mind that If he's trying to get better.
Remember, he works in like Pointe-aux-Trembles and he works in Longueuil. If he doesn't have his car, he's screwed.
What about the baby on
board,
though?
He's screwed.
The baby on board.
There's no baby.
There could be in the next car.
Hey, Holmes, we're missing. Yeah. We're missing one. Come on, commit. I want to see what. 16. There we go. This is a real case, guys.
How much is he smoking?
A few joints.
It doesn't matter.
Every day.
Every day.
It's fine, yeah. It's okay.
It is a criminal offense, by the way, to drive your vehicle while intoxicated. Whether you are intoxicated with a legal substance or an illegal substance is irrelevant. If I prescribe you Valium and you take it the way it is prescribed, but you take two Valium and you get into the car and you drive while intoxicated, that is a criminal offense. You are driving while intoxicated. It doesn't matter if the substance is legal or illegal. It doesn't matter what the context is. If you're intoxicated, you must not be driving. Now, if you are smoking weed while you're driving, you are intoxicated while you're driving. Now, I omitted to tell you, I deliberately made this a little bit more difficult than it really was. He actually told me in the office that he was blacking out while he was driving.
Okay,
so
hang on.
Why do you even call the CMQ?
So obviously you would call.
To make sure you're protected.
Yeah, I want to make sure that I'm not going to get like sued here and there. Yes.
I just wanted to be clear, though. It's not the fact that it's a criminal offense. That's not what's important. What's important is that other people's lives are in danger, right?
That is correct. If you tell me that you're a hitman...
Yeah. But you're not eminently about to hit anyone.
But I'm in therapy here. I don't have my list. You know, I don't have my 3 o'clock appointment. Thank you.
I used to be
a hitman. Yesterday, this morning, you are not obliged to report this individual.
I think you actually can, right?
You can't. You're right. You can't.
Right.
You can't just phone up the police and say, "Hi, I saw a bad guy in my office." You can't do that. Sometimes I'd like to, but you can't. But if the guy says, "You know what? Come on, Doc. I'm in a rush here because I'm a hitman and I got a 3 o'clock appointment here." That's a different story because now the person is telling you that he's got a homicidal contract out. Yes, then you do have to report the individual. Yes.
So if you were the scenario in your office where you had a 25-year-old kid. And he started talking about what he does on the weekend, and he admits that sometimes he goes out and you know, has a bit of weed and drives, and he says, you know, doc, I drive okay. Would you call the SAQ? He doesn't black out. He says, nothing's ever happened. It's never been an issue.
Honestly, it would be a judgment call.
Yeah.
What I would, it would be a judgment call, and it's a very, very difficult, it's a very fine line.
Because that's like what I kind of thought the question was.
It's a very, very fine line. You could phone him. You could phone him, and you could report him, and if you did that, you would probably be doing a favor both to him and to society.
Yeah.
Now, if you chose not to follow up, what you would have to do at that point is, I don't know, do urine drug testing on the guy, and to see if he stopped smoking weed. If he comes to you and says, I'm smoking weed and I want to stop, and I've stopped for 2 weeks, then I probably would be less inclined to report him. I might do a urine drug test. If the guy comes in and says, I'm smoking weed and it's not a big deal, is it, doc? And I say, yeah, you really shouldn't. He said, yeah, whatever. I probably would report him.
But I mean, I feel like that must happen all the time.
Exactly, which is why the coroner actually went to the trouble of sending out an email to medical faculty saying,
really?
You guys have to start reporting people, guys, come on.
But then people are going to stop telling their doctor that, like, it's not going to last.
But it's
going to
be less dangerous on the road.
I don't know.
Remember, we don't have a legal obligation. In other provinces, there are legal obligations. In other provinces, there are legal obligations.
Right.
And there are certain mandatory reporting things.
What's the recourse for the driver when you discuss it? So you report to SAQ, then what happens?
He loses license. The SAC says you have an immediate roadside suspension. Gone. Don't drive.
When do you get it back? Do they test negative or something?
3 months or 6 months. And to get it back, you have to go through a special, you have to jump through a bunch of hoops set out by the SAEQ. I don't know what those hoops are, but you have to go through certain rehab programs.
So it's not like such a major recourse for the patient anyway. It's not like they're going to jail.
No, but he's going to lose his job, which then is going to probably put him into foreclosure. He's going to lose his house. Because he's going to sort of spiral downwards, he might kill himself. You know, he's got kids. The kids are going to be taken away by youth protection. I mean, remember, this guy's got a rough life, yes.
There's too many other people at risk. Sorry,
Devin.
Oh,
here's
a good
one.
I just
one.
Had a question.
This is like mine.
You mentioned you can't drive if intoxicated, even if you're taking prescription meds. So you're saying that a person who takes Dilaudid once a day for their back pain can drive?
No. What I'm saying is that you cannot take it if you are intoxicated. Now, if you take your Ativan 1 milligram 4 times a day every day for the past 10 years, you have a pharmacological dependence. You are no longer asleep. You could drive and you're not intoxicated. You are not under the influence. Your faculties are okay.
Mm-hmm. Is that not a problem?
That's not a problem. If you drive at 4 in the morning and you fall asleep at the wheel, you are driving, even with no medications on board, nothing on board. You're on a state, but you fall asleep at the wheel. Technically, you are driving with under impaired contexts. And you can get into trouble for that. You didn't take anything. You just fell asleep because it happened to be 4 in the morning. You should have had the insight to know, I can't drive. That's what the law is getting at.
So what about in a hospital setting where someone comes in like from an accident, and you find, I don't know, alcohol in their blood or whatever it is that you find in their blood, what do you do at that point?
Yeah, so the issue has to do with, so in an emergency room, let's say a trauma center, the guy comes in after a motor vehicle accident, he was the driver, and he reeks of alcohol. What do? That's past, that's not future. You could report to the SAC that this person has a, do you have the diagnosis of substance abuse? Not necessarily. If you go out right now at lunch, down a 40-ouncer of vodka, get behind your car and drive, you don't actually have a diagnosis of substance abuse or substance dependence. You're just driving drunk.
Right.
So I don't necessarily, if I happen to have caught you at that point in time, there's no medical reason to report you. Now, could I phone up the police and say, hi, I have somebody who's drunk driving, you can charge them? No, that I do not have a legal obligation. I do not have the authority to do that. There are certain mandatory reporting things, and honestly, I'm not an emerge doc. I don't know the details. I'm not going to tell you what is or isn't. Gunshot wounds come to mind. Knife wounds, I know, has been gunshot wounds, I know, has been debated. Knife wounds, I know, has been debated as mandatory reporting, in which case the emerge doc is obliged to where the laws are, what the status is, I honestly don't know, and I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
I thought motor vehicle accidents where alcohol was potentially a contributing factor was required reporting.
I think they're required to fill a form afterwards.
In Ontario,
so okay. Have to
in different provinces. And here in Quebec, I don't believe it is. I don't believe it's a mandatory. It might be. It might be. I don't think so though.
But I had a patient who had an MBA who came to the clinic.
What? Sorry.
It's a patient. She had an MBA. Came to the went to the emergency room, and came to the clinic because she was phoned by the SAQ because she was trying to get insurance claim, I guess. And it's to report that she's not responsible. That then you have to fill a form to say that she didn't have like the faculties that could be when during that accident.
That sounds like a weird scenario.
How would you know?
You would have no way of you would have no way of knowing if you would have had a factor to FAP.
No, and that's why she had like we told her you have to fill it in by the emergency doctor. So they have like there is a form post accident, I guess, that can catch some of this.
You brought up the point of dependence of cannabis.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that apply with marijuana?
Yes. But that also meets the if you have a pharmacological dependence to marijuana, you, with the exception of prescription marijuana, which I think is now into legal limbo, you are still consuming an illegal substance.
But before you said it's not.
It's not
illegal
or illegal.
That's the issue.
It's the intoxication. The issue is that though that you could be consuming alcohol, if you're drunk driving, I'm going to report you.
Let's say it's Marinol.
Yeah.
So
Marinol prescription.
Yeah.
Does the individual have Marinol prescription? Is your get out of jail free card? Because you're going to test positive for cannabis. Mm-hmm. And if you test positive for cannabis, I'm going to say pee into the cup. You test positive, I'm going to say do you smoke weed? You're going to say no. It's impossible to know whether or not that statement is true or not true. But as long as you're not impaired functioning, you're okay. Technically, as a physician, when you prescribe a substance with a mood, a potential to alter your mood, mind altering substances. Think back to coroner's case number one. Technically, you are obliged to advise the patient not to drive while they're intoxicated. If you do not do that, and the patient still drives while intoxicated and says, "But I didn't know." There have been legal recourses in which the physicians have been roped into have been snagged. It's tough. It's rough. And you say, "But I didn't do anything wrong." Well, there you go.
So
lying by omission is a lie. Omitting information gets you into trouble. Also, yes.
So when you prescribe a patient like a medication like opioids or Ativan,
don't drive. It's going to knock you out. You should not drive a motor vehicle while you're.
And you have to document that in the chart.
If you really want to be anal retentive, you document that in your chart. Mm-hmm. The reality is that probably very few physicians actually do that.
Yeah.
The reality is that probably everyone should be doing that.
Should the pharmacist have to be doing that?
Sure they do. You ever seen that? There's a ball that has a little sticker on it that says, "Don't drink and drive. Don't use and drive."
So shouldn't it be the pharmacist's obligation, not the doctor's?
It is a shared responsibility.
So both of you and the pharmacist.
Both of you are
going to
get roped in. The pharmacist is going to say, "Hey, I got a sticker that I put on the pill bottle that the guy saw. It may cause drowsiness. I'm okay." The pharmacist is off the hook. Who's left standing in front of the judge?
The doctor didn't write it in the chart.
Correct. So.
Were you suggesting to take Benadryl and you took it over the counter?
Yep. Yep. Mr. K, I thought he struck really close to home. He's a 24-year-old medical student who sees you for an annual exam. He's got no complaints, no issues, feels well, all is well. You ask about alcohol and drug use, and he says he smokes weed occasionally, just a few evenings a week. You know, it's not a whole lot. I really strike close to home and sick of calling him a medical student. What do you document in the chair? Do you say that he's an occasional drug user? Do you say that he's marijuana usage 2 to 3 times per week? Or do you write nothing because it could come back and haunt him when he's applying for disability insurance? Have you guys had your disability insurance lectures yet?
No.
Well, guess what? Disability insurance companies are going to try and sell you all private insurance, and if you sign on, they're going to say, "Please sign to authorize us access to your medical chart." And they will have access to your medical chart.
I don't have a chart.
It's better.
Well,
have
you
ever seen a doctor?
I don't
know.
No.
I don't see
doctors. You go to Peru for a self.
Yes,
what do you document in the chart, guys? Remember, he's a medical student. He's one of yours. Occasional drug use, marijuana use, or nothing. So we got him pretty even split here. Who said number one? Show of hands. Show of hands. Who said number one? Put your hands high up. I want to see your hands. Okay, great. Thank you. Who said number two? Great. Okay, who said number three? Oh, come on, guys. Come on. Who said number three?
They're clearly the liar.
Beware. If you can't put your hand here in this room, it's going to be hard, much harder when your patient is in the room and is cornering you with us. Number three is actually an incorrect answer. Number two is the correct answer. Number one is actually an incorrect answer. Because if you say occasional drug use, is that smoking 2 to 3 joints a week? Or is that snorting the occasional cocaine a few times a day? Not too much, though. What is occasional drug use? We don't know. Because it's intentionally vague. And it can actually be more damning than it really is. He's only shooting up a little bit of heroin. You know, yeah. If you say number two, you're letting the cards fall where they're going to fall. And you're stepping away. If you do number three, you're right. This is going to come back, and this could come back and haunt this guy. But that's the incorrect answer. You must document. You must document this. Mr. J, this is the last scenario. He's an 86. Yes.
Just a question on that, though. Like,
yes.
I guess in this case, he was very specific. But like, what if you just said, you know, I have some marijuana? Like,
okay.
Do you have to always be...
What am I going to do as a physician if you told me, okay, hi, do you smoke weed? Say
yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
how much weed do you smoke? How much weed do you smoke? How much weed do you smoke?
A couple times a week.
Yeah. Do you buy, like, you okay, do you grow it or do you buy it or you buy it?
Sure.
Yeah, so how often does your 7 grams last? You buy in units of 7 grams? Yeah. Yeah. So let's say you buy it in units of 7 grams. How long does that baggie last you? Now what I'm doing is I'm quantifying it more, and I'm asking much more specific questions. It's the same thing. How many glasses of wine do you drink? Well, that depends. How do you have a little glass or do you have a big glass of something? There are glasses. So the real question is, how long does a bottle of wine last you? Because you know it's going to be either 6 or 8 if it's 750 or 1 liter for standard drinks. From there, you can get a more accurate measure because if, you know, if you drink 5 glasses of wine, but the glasses of wine like that is probably nothing.
But I guess my question is more like you said it was the wrong answer.
Yes.
But then a couple slides back, it was not every doctor's going to document that.
Correct.
Benadryl makes you drowsy.
Yeah.
So, like, especially for a medical student while visit, like, you don't need to be so anal about everything. So, do you have some drug use? Yes, occasionally. Okay, occasional drug use. Like,
yeah, but you would always ask what kind of drugs are
you
taking.
So
someone says,
use,
if someone says,
like, how far in?
If someone says occasional drug use, your job for a periodic health exam is to dance around on the surface, and you're going to try and see, are there any weak spots? As soon as you find the weak spot, you're going to home in on that, and you're going to start asking more questions. If you say occasional drug use, I'm going to home in on that. If you say, you know what, I'm pretty good, I just get a little short of breath when I walk up the stairs, I'm going to home in on that, and I'm going to ask you 25 questions about that. I'm going to examine you a lot more because of that. So I am going to explore further, and I'm going to home in on the hot spots. And I'm going to dance around a little bit more, and okay, yeah, you don't have any digestive problems, so it's okay. No, you have any weight loss? No, I'll check. You have any lung problems? Are you short of breath? No. So ask some vague questions, but as soon as you start getting yes to the vague questions, you have to zoom in more. Occasional drug use, that's a soft spot. You got to zoom in more. 86-year-old man. He lives with a disabled wife. She lives in Notre-Dame-de-Grasse. He drives his wife to medical appointments. NDG, for those of you who don't know, it's about 25 blocks that way, and it's a nice little suburbia area. There are buses, but really car, if you want to get places, there are a lot of people have cars there. He drives his wife to medical appointments, states he avoids highways, states he doesn't drive at night, and he denies any past driving infractions or collisions, and he gives you this M28 form because he's 86 years old, and you got to fill this out.
Denied.
Do you have any questions so far?
Why isn't he driving at night?
Why what?
Why won't he drive at night?
Well, he doesn't like driving at night because he knows that, you know, he doesn't see as well, and like, his reaction time's a little bad, and so he only drives on like on he only drives on like the side streets. And he only drives where he like he knows where he's driving. If he said, for example, oh, we got a trip to go to Toronto, he wouldn't drive to Toronto. He would take public transit and get his friend to drive him around Toronto. He wouldn't rent a car in Vancouver because he doesn't know the streets in Vancouver.
Okay, how's his vision?
Not bad.
Acceptable for driving?
Okay, we're not on the physical exam yet. Do you have a question? I'm going to get the physical exam in a moment.
Yeah, your
reaction time, I'm getting old. A lot of people on their own, the normal person will tend to automatically restrict. And progressively, you'll see the pattern as they restrict their driving. They only drive in the cities they know. They only drive in the neighborhoods they know. They only drive on certain roads that they feel are safe. They only drive under certain time or certain conditions. They don't drive in the winter at all, or they don't drive at night, or you know, they impose their own restrictions. But most people will do this.
How far away is wife's medical?
Oh, he's an NDG. Yeah, she's at the Royal Vic and Jewish General and St. Mary's.
It doesn't really matter, right? Because a driver's license is not like, you don't get a driver's license to only drive in a certain area, so.
Well, on his exam, you know that he moves, he talks and responds slowly, but appropriately. He has a mini-mental, you do a mini-mental status exam on him. He scores a 24. He loses a point for drawing, he loses a 3 points for the three-word recall, and he loses 2 points for the serial sevens. So he's lost some points there. There are no complicating or competing medical diagnoses. Keep it simple. So therefore, he doesn't have hypertension, he doesn't have diabetes, he's not blind with cataracts, he doesn't have kidney failure, he's not on 25 medications. There we go. Any questions so far?
So what's his diagnosis based on the MMS?
Well, it's not a diagnostic tool. It's a screening tool.
No, I know, but is there a neurologist evaluating him at a memory
not yet.
Clinic?
No, we don't have any. We don't have anything. We don't have anything. The guy just comes in and he says, "Well, there you go." You express your concern to Mr. J about his deficiencies. You tell him, "Listen, you know, you're scoring a 24 on your mini mental. I'm concerned about you. You're not a spring chicken. How about we try to stop driving here?" So he replies that he drives slowly during the day on side streets and he needs his license to survive. Without his ability to drive, the couple will have to move likely to a senior's home at a cost between $4,000 to $10,000 a month, money he will not be able to afford. And they're already on a wait list for a government-subsidized residence, but they've been told they can wait for up to 5 years. This, by the way, guys, is a growing social problem across North America and across the world. When you guys are in practice, and while I'm in practice, this is going to become more and more and more frequent. This is not one of these red herring, weird, whacked out cases. This is going, you're going to get this on a repeated basis.
Why can't I take a taxi?
He strongly urges you to complete the form in a way that permits him to continue to drive. So the question was raised, why can't he just take a taxi? Do you have any idea how much a taxi costs?
$4,000.
Do they have family in the city?
No.
I don't think you're able to complete the form right now. Because you did a screening
form. He's in front of you. He's got this form. It must be completed by February 28th.
When they send the form for driver's license,
yes,
they send it ahead of when you have to renew your
correct
license.
Correct. It sends it 3 months in advance. He comes to you because, well, he phoned you up the very next day, but your clinic was full.
You can't make a judgment whether he's not impaired or mild cognitive where you have to refer to another doctor.
What do you write down? Everything is fine, or do you say he's got possible mild dementia versus MCI?
Do you have the ability to make a diagnosis?
You've taken your history. Does he have mild cognitive impairment?
Yes.
He probably does.
It's not so easy to say.
It's not. It's not. But if you do your mini mental you watch the guy function, you watch the guy walk, you watch the guy talk, you've taken your history. Could he have mild cognitive impairment? Now, remember, there are no competing medical diagnoses. If there was a huge language barrier, if the guy was deaf and couldn't hear you when you said the three words, so he couldn't get the three-word recall. No, there are competing medical issues that could give you the impression that he's got an MCI. In this case, there are no competing other medical issues going on. You have to posted up your hand. You have something to say.
Yeah, I was just wanted to say that, like, I think that, like, an important thing to realize is that it's not our job to determine whether he's able to drive or not. It's just our job to, because I know there's another organization that does that. We just have to report anything we think that might be a concern. That's actually up to someone else to decide whether he's fit to drive or not.
Will he go for a test? Like, is that how
you can do that? Yeah.
You are the eyes and the ears of the SAAQ. The SAAQ is a machine. It doesn't have any. It doesn't have any ability to evaluate the patient itself. All they know is what you complete on these forms.
Really? Okay.
That's all they know.
I guess it's
so
different
you
in
are
Ontario.
You are the eyes and the ears. If you think, the first question is, what do you write on the form? Everything is fine or possible mild dementia versus MCI? I'm gonna answer your question
but
in a moment.
On the form, though, can't you write neither and say that he needs further follow-up by a specialist?
You can't say neither, but further follow-up, you can request other things. And I'm going to pass this around. I'm going to show this to you. Yes, you can request other things. And there is another organization, Constance Lethbridge in this part of Montreal, does do roadside assessments. But right now, he's in your office. You've got a paper in front of you. You can't say neither needs further assessment. If you think he needs further assessment, you better say number two.
Further assessment for what? Be like, okay.
Thank you. You recommend no further evaluation. You recommend a neurology evaluation, and you recommend a road test at the cost of the patient. Now, if you keep in mind, this is at the cost of the patient. There is here, under recommendations, in your opinion, should the Société require this individual to submit to additional assessments? Yes or no?
That's the road test?
If yes, what type? On-road assessment by the Société. Functional assessment by occupational therapist or specialized consultations? So the OT would say, you know, can you get into the car? Can you get out of the car? Can you move? You're driving a standard. Can you drive the standard? The on-road assessment is the person who sits beside the person and says, let's see you drive.
But they also have a screening tool for driver's test.
I'm sure they do.
I can predict whether or not he would fail a road test.
If the guy's bumping into the wall and can't sign his name, he's probably going to fail the test. You're right. They do have a screening test. Honestly, I don't know the screening test. But they presumably would do this. What do you recommend? What do you recommend, guys? 13.
But
come on.
No OT option.
It doesn't have OT option, so you would say 3.
Okay.
3 is the closest thing to OT. Someone's still on the fence. It's not hard. Come on, guys.
Sometimes the responses don't pick up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone click a second time. Thank you. That's a pretty even split. Whether you choose a neurology evaluation or a road test, no, if you were more interested from a clinical standpoint, you could say a neurology evaluation. If you wanted to say whether or not, look, what I care about the most is can he drive, then you would say more the road test. And it really depends on either or. You could even do both. In reality, you could do both. Mm-hmm. That's not a bad option either.
The neurologist would be required if they think that the person cannot drive to report that, I think.
No.
No?
No. You are a family physician. You can report.
But
I'm saying
a
family physician can make a diagnosis of dementia.
Yes.
But if on that form,
like, even in the memory clinic at the Jewish, when they do MMSEs in the morning, they usually meet together, like an entire group, to discuss the case to give a diagnosis.
In the memory clinic, you see, like, the
No, you see, and tons of MCI there, and they're all discussing that.
Okay, here's the deal.
No, but
I saw a guy. I saw a guy. Okay, guys.
Yeah.
Guys, family physicians can do a lot.
Physicians
can establish a diagnosis, absolutely. And as a family physician, if you shuck your responsibility and say, I'm not going to make that diagnosis, I'll turf it over to the neurologist. So I had a patient who was, English and French was not his first language, and he was partly deaf. And I had a hearing test and everything. So from that standpoint, that was okay. But when I'm doing the mini mental on this guy, he's getting like 19 and 20. And I can see that he's not necessarily functioning well, but at the same time, I know that it's not a representative measure of his cognitive capacity. So I'm stuck. I've got a low mini mental, while at the same time, I've got competing medical and social reasons and real reasons why he probably could get a low. So what I did was I did send him to neurology, and I said, please, neurology, please weigh in on this. Help me out here. And you know what neurology said? You're right, David. Maybe he could have MCI. Maybe he could be sick. Maybe it could be related to his language issues. Maybe it could be related to his hearing issues. You're absolutely right. And then the patient came back with another one of these forms and said, and the government wants you to fill this out now again. So I phoned up the government and I said, what the hell's going on? And the government said, well, you're the family doctor. The buck stops with you. So the neurology evaluation is useful from a clinical standpoint. If you're concerned about, is it MCI? Is it Lewy body dementia? Are you going to prescribe Aricept? Are you not going to prescribe Aricept? And you're not sure? How do you proceed? Whether you want a geriatrics assessment, a neurology assessment, you could go that route. But this is from a clinical medical standpoint. From a regulatory standpoint, you're the one who's signing this form. You're the one whose name goes on the form. And if you wanted to do a road test, you could. I had a patient who came into my office who did. I said, please do a road test. Why? Because she's a very nice little pleasant old lady who had this funny feeling. It gave me a funny feeling inside that this lady probably maybe might have small impairments in driving, and I just wanted to cover my bases. A few weeks later, I get back a very angry letter from an OT who I think I shaved off a few years of this poor OT's life, who said, basically, what did you do this for me for? You almost killed me. And apparently this lady had trouble getting into the car. She was accelerating to red lights. She was stopping at green lights. She was swerving all over the place. She didn't know the gas pedal. She didn't know the brake pedal. She was like, I'm reading this report, and I'm like, oh, this is bad. And this lady then came back in and said, well, the government, I don't know what happened. The government took my license away. And they said that if I wanted it back, that I could come to you and you can fill out this form now, and I can take my license back. But the worst is, she didn't come back to me, she came back to one of our residents here, who didn't see the first report and didn't see the OT evaluation. So the resident dutifully filled out the form and asked the questions and didn't know about this awful scenario. By chance, I happened to have been the supervisor of the day, and I said, oh, did you look in the chart by any chance? And we subsequently put an end to that. You'll be surprised and amazed. I had no idea that her disability was so profound based on the clinical evaluation in the office. If you're concerned, you can order a...
The opposite, though, can be also true. Have a patient with diagnosed Alzheimer's, she's not even sure she would recognize me if I were to meet her. But like her husband, like, oh, yeah, she's driving safely still. And I sent her... I'm sending her every single year, because every year she has to fill the form, and every year I'm just requesting a driving test. And so far, the last
she
year passes
she passes.
She's safe on the road. She has memory loss, obviously. I'm not sure she might forget where she's going.
But she gets there somehow.
Wherever
it is.
This is a dirty question that the SAC added on to the forms here. And this is actually, should this individual cease driving while awaiting these assessments?
Guy,
yes,
86.
He's an 86-year-old guy. Should this individual cease driving while awaiting these assessments? Yes or no? That's I didn't come up with this. This is the government.
No, my fault.
Okay, click again. Thank you. You know, this is a judgment call. There's no right or wrong answer, and clearly it depends on your evaluation of how the patient is doing. Do you think that the driver should stop driving or should not stop driving? Keep in mind that there are consequences. There are real consequences to the patient if you say you can't drive effective now until you get your roadside assessment. There are also, keeping in mind that there are waiting lists to do that roadside assessment. It's not going to happen tomorrow. And there are consequences if you say you can allow the guy to keep driving, knowing that he could kill somebody, he could kill your neighbor's kid, and you have to live with that in your conscience. So there are, depending on your evaluation, you might decide that he should or shouldn't. As a doctor, you have the right to report to the SAC any concerns you have about your patient with regards to his or her ability to safely operate a motor vehicle. You do not need to break, you do not need patient consent to break confidentiality, although the Collège des Médecins and the CMPA have both said that it is wise to obtain it if possible, because the patient is much less likely to commence legal challenges or regulatory challenges against you if you tell them what you're going to do before you do it. Having said that, do put your personal safety, do not put your own personal safety at risk. If you're concerned that the patient's going to like pull out a gun and shoot you in the office, maybe you might not want to tell him to that to his face what you're going to do. Although you do not have an obligation to volunteer such information, again, you have the freedom to do so. You do not have an obligation to volunteer such information. Legal challenges have been critical of physicians who have chosen not to report such information. And the position of the CMPA, these are the people who ensure us medical malpractice, they strongly encourage us to report. What are the lessons for today? You must be honest with the reporting system. This is why the company, insurance, school, government is asking you to fill out the form and not the patient. There will be times when the patient suffers from the consequences of an accurately filled out form. And don't feel that you're stuck in a false decision. You can always include extra information if you feel it's relevant and will help the patient. In the context of the first alcoholic guy, depression with possible alcohol abuse, I would probably add in, patient is going to start an inpatient rehab center imminently, confirmed with rehab center. I would put that down. At the very least, it may actually help him. But you can always add more information if you think it would be helpful. What are these losses of privileges? You can lose your driving privileges with the subsequent loss of job or ability to shop. You could lose your insurance coverage with the subsequent loss of food or housing. If you don't have money, it's hard to pay for your food and hard to pay your mortgage. You could lose your spouse in the context of a madu of chlamydia. You don't want to tell your spouse that you have chlamydia. Well, guess what? I have to report this to public health. You could lose even your freedom under garde préventive. If you have imminent danger to self or others, under garde préventive, I will put you into that context, yes.
So about the chlamydia.
Yeah.
When I was doing gynae and stuff, like there were new diagnoses of chlamydia and stuff like that. I never once heard a doctor tell the patient that it's going to
public health.
Yeah, like do we not have an obligation or at least like a...
Okay, there are two levels here. One, did they tell the patient that it was going to public health? And the second is, did they fill out the form?
I never saw them fill out a form.
Right. So
I don't know.
You know, I did a rotation in Wakefield when I was a resident, and I saw a patient who had measles. And I said, this was 10 years ago, and I said, cool, it's measles. I had not seen a case of measles before, so I mean, I learned clinically what measles looked like. I mean, I had it myself when I was a kid, but that's another story. So I said to the physician, to the emerge doc, I said, where's the madu? He looked at me and said, what? It's a measles, it's a madu, it's a maladie à déclaration obligatoire. I said, no, it's not. So, yes, it is. I just wrote my exams. I know, this is a MADU. So we pulled out the MADU form. I looked in the back, and it says measles. I said, it's a reportable disease. I said, I've never filled out one of those forms. I'm not filling out that form. I said, well, what? Me as a resident, I'm going to fill this out? He said, well, you do what you want. And he says, everyone's got measles. What are you talking about? This is 10 years ago. This is not present day. There's a measles outbreak now, but guess what? This measles outbreak has been brewing for quite some time. So he talks to one of the nurses and says, hey, did your kid have measles? Yeah. Did the doctor ever report your kid to public health? No. He looks at me like I'm from outer space. But you know what? You have an obligation to report. Now, what happens is some physicians will say, yeah, but I don't have to report it because the lab is going to report it directly. So I don't have to fill that out. You're shucking responsibility. You have shared responsibility. Technically speaking, you are in violation of your ordre de déontologie. There's a reason why there's an O under MADU. It's not optional. It's obligatoire.
It is.
And there's an obligatoire means you must. Now, whether you tell the patient that you're going to report to public health or not, that it might be a good idea that you do it. But you don't certainly have to. I mean, I think I've filled out a MADU before and I haven't told them. But you do have to fill out a MADU. You have to fill it out. If the patient walks out at the end of the day and you fill out 10 MADUs, you could do that. Maybe you didn't see that.
Maybe.
My suspicion is that maybe people weren't filling out the forms the way that they should.
I have no idea.
I just finished my rural in Ontario, and they have, I don't know if it's the same here, but they have the idea of a most responsible physician in terms of who fills out all these forms and who needs to report what. So, like, going back to the consultant's question, if you consult in neurology, neurologists would not report anything.
Yeah.
They would just write it in their report and say, I recommend that you report this, blah, blah, blah.
And then
blah,
send
blah.
It back to you.
And then you are actually the most responsible physician as a pathologist. Is this
correct.
The same in Quebec?
There is no official stance, but that's certainly a responsible stance.
Yeah.
Because it allows for the worst case scenario for a patient is to have multiple physicians reporting multiple
yeah.
different angles. No one knows what's coming. You don't know if you're coming or going or what's going on. The most responsible thing, especially when there's consultants around and there's forms to be filled, is that it comes back to the treating physician to actually have one unified front and say, this is what's going on.
And then there was the other complication that if you were a patient of a walk-in clinic and you go to a consultant, then it might be the consultant's responsibility to report. So
yeah.
That was also
yeah. Again, I'm not aware of any official guidelines or stances of the government, but certainly that falls on the under the obligations as a physician to treat the patient accordingly, regardless of what type of doctor or under the context. That's the bottom line. Forms must be filled completely and accurately. And if you do want to know a little bit more information about forms, there's a whole CMPA article on forms and reporting the case for care. This is in 2008, but it's extremely relevant even today. And thank you. And also fill out your evaluation forms.
Completely anonymous.
Completely anonymous. I'm not going to click you on those ones. There you go. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Clapping.